Good?
Yeah. Can you start over?
We're on. Okay. Let's do one more time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's May 19th, 2011. It's 7 minutes after 3. Sorry about that. And welcome to Hearing Room E for Rules Committee. For the next hour, we're going to listen to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3664. And I'm just going to kind of explain a little bit what's happening here. We'll have two panels that will share that are proponents of the bill, and then there's going to be a panel in opposition. And then I'm going to open up to anyone that has signed up, because as you can see, I have a few folks that, you know, I mean, you're very interested in wanting to speak. To be able to fill the balance of the hour, because as far as I'm concerned, my testimony is going to go quickly from the proponent side of it. We're going to try to get as many as we can of you to share your perspective for the balance of the hour. And then at we'll say roughly at 4:10, then we'll end this hearing on this bill. So that will be it. Okay.
Would you like a brief description?
Absolutely.
Or
if you
a
would,
thorough description?
which
would you like?
A thorough description.
All right, I will do the thorough. This is House Bill 3664, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is for Oregon's Medical Marijuana Act. It requires written documentation from attending physician that medical use of marijuana will provide therapeutic value. It prohibits a person convicted of manufacture or delivery of controlled substance from being designated caregiver of registry identification card holder. It allows designation beginning 5 years after conviction for persons with single conviction. It requires that the Oregon Health Authority do a criminal records check on persons whose names are submitted as designated primary caregivers each time the name is submitted and charge a fee for the criminal record check. It authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to impose a fee for registration of a marijuana grow site. For registry identification card holders under 18 years of age, it requires documentation from attending physician who specializes in the treatment of children and that the registry be renewed every 3 months with documentation from the attending physician that the medical use of marijuana provides therapeutic value. It requires information on marijuana grow sites to be released by the Oregon Health Authority to law enforcement agencies to include the number of card holders for whom the site is producing marijuana, the number of persons authorized to produce marijuana at the site, and once each quarter, a list of addresses of all registered grow sites. It makes provisions operative beginning January 1st, 2012, and it declares an emergency effective upon passage. You have the -1 amendment, which we have added to the website of the committee. It adds a definition of provides therapeutic value. It changes the measures registry renewal requirement for cardholders under 18 years of age from every 3 months to every 6 months. And it directs the Department of State Police to adopt rules governing the release of marijuana grow site registration information. We also have provided for members, and I think there are a few extra copies, and it's I believe it's also posted on the website, a what we call a hand engrossed with the original measure with the -1s included.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Also, committee members, just want to introduce to you Aaron Knott from Judiciary. On the far end there, Representative Barnhart, he's kind of helped with this as well. So he's going to sit in.
So Representative Wilson, is it just going to be the two of you and Representative Barker, or is there a third person on this first panel?
There will be a following panel.
Okay. Representative Wilson, nice for you to bring along your younger brother for this.
this was my older brother. He pointed out to me. Okay. Chair Hunt, committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm a member of the House of Representatives out of the Albany area. House Bill 3664 is an omnibus bill, a collection of concepts from several other bills, to be exact, 20 bills in all, that have been introduced this session from senators and representatives. Being in my fourth term, I've learned that when there are that many bills with similar themes, there exists a major problem, a major concern. As a result, it doesn't make sense to listen to every individual bill, but to put a work group together to develop a good policy. That's what we did in 2005, addressing the concerns of methamphetamine, and in 2009, addressing the issues with metal theft. I want you to realize the work group that consisted of representatives Krieger, Kotek, Barker, and myself have been very sensitive to the concerns by fellow legislators and by the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act community. We moved forward crafting this bill considering two key components. The first one was that we were concerned that we would protect the current law that allows patients who need medical marijuana. And the second piece is that we wanted to create boundaries that would prevent the abuse of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. A few months ago in the Judiciary Committee, we listened to a bill that would prohibit a patient from using medical marijuana if they had been convicted of a felony drug offense. On the surface, that may appear to be a bill that makes sense. But if you get into, there's a pun, into the weeds, you find out that, really, a person commits a crime, deal with it appropriately, don't take away their medicine. So that was one of the things I learned from that. But also what was kind of interesting, Mr. Chair and committee members, while I was there during that committee meeting, I had an opportunity to really listen to the concerns of a lot of the folks, a lot of them behind me right now, over there, that they addressed about this whole issue. And I had a chance to kind of meet a few of them as well. So I started paying attention to what their concerns were regarding this whole thing. But let me go through a little bit of what this bill does. First, it restricts the eligibility for Oregon residents. Currently, right now, under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, the bill allows out-of-state resident eligibility to apply for Oregon medical marijuana. That's a loophole that we need to get squared away, and we are doing that with this bill. The second thing, it establishes boundaries for the use of medical marijuana under the age of 18 years of age. Currently, there's somewhere between 40 to 50 patients who are under age 18 that are registered under OMA. And what this portion does, basically, is it describes physical conditions and that they would twice a year have an evaluation by their attending physician who specializes in children to report back to the OMMP or the program. Third thing was it requires that attending physicians must list therapeutic value of medical marijuana upon issuing a permit. And here, this is just one of the points I want to share with you because this is what the Dash Ones, a portion of the Dash Ones does with this for the amendments, is the therapeutic value originally did not have a definition of what that meant. It had some concerns from what some of the advocates of OMA shared with me. So I went down and I addressed what I felt was some of the issues. And that now, therapeutic value means mitigates the symptoms or effects of a person's debilitating medical condition. The fourth one requires an annual National Information Crime System check, which is NICS, to be conducted for both the grower and the caregiver, and includes out-of-state and federal convictions toward that. The fifth point, what the bill does, it adds five-year revocation to caregiver upon conviction for controlled substance crime, and second conviction is permanent. Now, currently under OMA, that applies to the grower. We've added the caregiver to that as well. The sixth point is it reduces the number of cardholders that a grower can grow for, and then somehow, I'm just going through the bill, Mr. Chair and committee members, and I'm seeing this is a piece that was left out. So I need to actually address this issue in an amendment. But the idea of where I wanted to go with number six was actually to reduce the amount of care or card holders that a grower could grow for from 4 to 2. Now, the reasoning behind that is actually to bring some accountability in, and it actually helps a little bit more for what we want to try to do to prevent abuse. And then also along with that, the growers would be would only apply to growers who are being at least 21 years of age. And then the last piece directs the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program to provide grower information to the Oregon State Police as a depository to be controlled access by law enforcement. And it gives the Oregon State Police rulemaking authority to adopt rules that govern the release of information from the information provided. Further digging into this right now, it does not make sense for me to go that direction, and so this should be probably addressed as well in an amendment, but that we would provide additional rulemaking authority with where this committee wants to go and this bill wants to go to OMMP. Do we have a problem? Indeed we do. And as we move forward with this issue, we must keep in mind we need to protect those who truly need medical marijuana, but at the same time stop the abuse. The panel that is going to be following me, Mr. Chair, will do a lot of explanation as to what the problem is, but at this point right now, Representative Parker, too, would like to share.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. I'm Jeff Parker, State Representative from House District 28. I'll just be very brief. When medical marijuana was presented to the voters a few years back, it was presented talking about cancer patients, AIDS patients, and so on that are in chemo, that had no appetite. This would help the appetite. For mobility impaired people who were in great pain and could find relief through marijuana. And I proudly voted for that bill at the time. I thought that was a good idea and that I didn't want anybody needlessly suffering. But also at that time, in the campaign, they were saying that they expected a maximum of 500 patients. And it's exceeded that by, you know, many thousands now. One of the problems, as I see it today, we're moving towards a point where the medical program is in jeopardy, where citizens might revoke the entire program, as Montana has just done, and that would not be good for the people who truly need it. There's complaints about the law enforcement knowing where the grow sites are, that some people have said, well, you can't do that because they'll come out and check. And somebody gave a number that they're already checking 100,000 a year. That's 243 a day. I don't think they're doing anywhere near that. But the point is, those sites need to be checked because we're hearing of abuse where people are growing not six plants, but, you know, like 60 or 6,000. So if they have access to that, it can be easily checked. A few years ago, I knew many people when I was a police officer who had federal firearms licenses, and they would see, so they weren't really truly dealers, commercial dealers, but they could deal with their friends, save you some money. And in those days, the ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, it makes me think who's bringing the chips. But they said, we're going to inspect those sites, your business site. And people had it at their home address. And people said, gee, that'll be a real hassle. I don't want to do it. So they gave up their license and quit doing it. So if people think it's too much of a hassle that the police might come and inspect the grow, they don't need to grow. I mean, that's just one of the things that we need to get under control. I thank the committee for taking a look at this and appreciate your due diligence in listening. And I appreciate all the citizens who are here to testify both ways so we can hopefully get a good product. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for these two witnesses?
You want to share? Okay.
Thank you.
We can hear somebody who actually inspects
that. Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Ishbel, Representative District 6. As we know, I believe we had 20-some bills that pertain to this particular issue. I think that our work group did a good job. I think they tried to make a very good bill out of a lot of different bills, and I think they've been very successful. Reading on this particular subject, it is a very valuable thing for medicinal purposes and for medical purposes. There are certain things that this particular marijuana does, in fact, help people. That's very obvious. And we don't want to take that away from legitimate people. I don't think that's the intent. At least it was never my intent. But I do think there are some abuses. In fact, I know there are some abuses. I think the people that legitimately use the product legitimately would like to see the people that abuse it be reined in. And I think this is what the attempt of what we're trying to do. If you look at the original bill, it's substantially different than what we have today. I would like to see us kind of get back to our basics. I'd like to see us get back to where we've come with this bill that we have today, because I think this bill is a very good bill, and I urge your support of it. I'm sure that my fellow representatives have outlined this with Representative Barker and Representative Olson, but I think it's a good bill, and I think it's a very doable bill.
Any questions? Representative Esquivel, thank you very much. Okay, the next panel I'd like to invite to the table, Brad Berry, Rafael Caso, and Ray Myers, please. And I think, Detective Myers, if you would kind of just share, you know, paint the picture a little bit more for us.
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Holvey, rest of the panel. I was asked here...
If you'd identify yourself, please.
My name is Harlan Ray Myers. I'm a detective in Grants Pass with the Grants Pass Department of Public Safety. I am assigned now to the Rogue Area Drug Enforcement Team. I've been a police officer for approximately 27 years. During that time, I spent my time in patrol, major crimes detectives, the narcotics team detective when it was called Joint down in Grants Pass from 95 to 2000, and then as a patrolman, and now as a forming member of the Rogue Area Drug Enforcement Team. I was asked here to talk about the abuses of the medical marijuana program and how we see it in the law enforcement community. And I can tell you that in Josephine County, and from talking to other detectives and police officers across the state, they are massive, in my professional opinion. And it has never been, up to this point, as bad as it is right now. A lot of people don't realize that the ability to hide behind the program the way it is right now is very easy. And once someone gets involved in this program, the amount of marijuana that can be grown just from a single grower who's growing for four people can be quite massive. A very poor grower of marijuana, in our experience that we've seen, can grow at least 2 pounds of marijuana per plant. Up to...
Listen, I don't need to have an outburst. Keep your laughter down and be respectful, because, listen, what we'll do is we'll just remove you. You understand? Okay, thank you.
First Amendment, sir?
Sir, you know what?
What about the First Amendment, sir?
Yeah. I would, if I might, Coach Charles, I would echo, we end up with a lot of difficult emotional issues in this committee. I think one of the best ways we get an opportunity to hear you and you hear each other is if we all respect each other. And so I just urge folks on both sides of the issue, we're all going to get a chance to hear each other today. I would agree with my co-chair. Let's maintain respectful.
Okay.
That'd be a great,
yeah, I think
that's a great request.
Yeah, if you could. Thank you.
How's that?
Is that better?
Okay. Thank you. Continuing to a very good grower, we've seen plants reaching heights of 16, 18 feet with a circumference of approximately 5 to 8 feet around. The plants that these that are being grown can harvest from 8, some are bragging about 15 pounds of dried usable product of bud from each tree, is what we call them. The amounts of marijuana that are excess for people that are growing are massive, and we have had experience with people that we have arrested and investigations that we have done where they have actually paid people to get their patient cards, and then they're promised marijuana as well as other cash whenever the crop is sold. To put it in perspective, just recently we had, and I'm speaking right now of all subjects associated with the medical marijuana program, just this week we did an investigation where medical marijuana growers in Josephine and Jackson County were co-opting their marijuana, and one female was taking it to Portland. At Portland, she would take between 75 and 100 pounds of marijuana, and this is dried, trimmed, usable bud, to Portland. They would place it into a pod or freight container, and it would be shipped back to Boston. And this is from between a half a dozen subjects she's been working with. And then she was being paid $3,000 a pound for that marijuana. The subjects on the East Coast in Boston were distributing it, and when they were selling it back there for quite more than $3,000 a pound, she would get the money and she would distribute it to others. We ended up arresting her and also arresting several other subjects during the course of this investigation just this week. One of the subjects that we were dealing with was a licensed medical marijuana grower. He was a patient, and he was a grower for three other people. In interviewing that subject, he has not worked since 2005. He is buying his own property in Josephine County, and during the course of the investigation, we located $120,000 in cash in his safe, and also between $20,000 and $40,000 in gold and silver bullion. And this is a subject, as I stated, has not worked since 2005 and had no real excuse for why he would have that kind of money or an explanation for it. So it kind of gives you an idea of how massive that is. Also, part of these co-conspirators were other warrants that we see are served, and we located five very intricate and elaborate indoor marijuana growing operations, probably 50 pounds of dried marijuana altogether, processed, ready to be sold. Also located at one of the locations was several fully automatic machine guns, silencers, and these are all Oregon Medical Marijuana Program grow sites. The problems that we have in Josephine County, the majority of all of the arrests that are made by the Rogue Area Drug Enforcement Team that have to do with marijuana are associated with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. It is foolish for people to break the law in trafficking, selling, producing marijuana, not to participate in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. It is easy for them to hide behind it. It makes it difficult for us to investigate, and it makes it difficult for us to prosecute. It is a relief if we actually get to a location and find that it is not an Oregon Medical Marijuana Program because of the ability for people to hide behind it. In regards to the law itself, when I say massive problems that we have with it, everything that we deal with, from someone on the street who is possessing marijuana just to ingest, to the far extreme of the subjects, like I described, that have the automatic weapons and is selling large amounts of marijuana, 90% or more is coming back to there associated with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. And one that also shocks the conscience is within a block of Grants Pass High School last year, we had a subject who was an Oregon medical marijuana patient who had marijuana in his apartment and was supplying it to high school students on their lunch break. So we have problems all the way, as I said, from people that are in possession of less than an ounce to the subjects who are taking 100 pounds, which this person had for the last 6 months, every month, to Portland and shipping it to Boston. And that is happening over and over again to just about every state in the continental United States.
Okay. Thank you. GA.
Sure. Thank you. Excuse me. Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I do, though, in fairness, should state that the Legislative Committee has not vetted this bill, so I'm not here on behalf of the association. I guess I'd like to go kind of off script ever so briefly for some of the notes that I made before I start. As we watched numbers of bills come through the legislature this year attempting to deal with the, and I would agree with my colleague on the right here with Ray's assertion, massive problems with the Oregon medical marijuana issue. It is clear that I think the public is having a growing concern about how Oregon medical marijuana is being handled. I say that in part because of not only the numbers of bills coming forward to try and address single issues, dual issues, three issues, but as a member of my community, I go out and I talk to my community about issues, and that includes discussions about the Oregon medical marijuana program. And trying to describe what it is, what it does, and the abuses that we see in our office and in law enforcement throughout the state, the community is really aghast at the abuses of the program. I will tell you that I start every single discussion with a community group that I'm not here to debate the usefulness of medical marijuana. And I, too, as Representative Olson said, I have no doubt that there are authentic uses for medical marijuana. This isn't about the the legitimate use of marijuana. These discussions are about the abuse of the Oregon medical marijuana program. And I'm guessing, I don't know these folks sitting behind me who are opposing this bill, who oppose changes to this program, but I'm going to guess that the vast majority of them are not the individuals that we deal with day in and day out in law enforcement. They're the people who are utilizing the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, in a way that aids their particular conditions through the appropriate use of marijuana. We are dealing in law enforcement with the daily abuse of this law, using it as a fence, a wall to hide behind for the illegitimate growing of marijuana, selling of marijuana, and distribution of marijuana throughout the state of Oregon and around the country. Having said that, again, I want to reiterate that the discussion here with law enforcement, as I talk with my law enforcement officers, is not about the legitimate use. It's about the brazen use of the system to get around marijuana laws, to grow it and to sell it. This bill doesn't repeal the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. It's trying to address some of the abuses that are being seen daily throughout the state. I want to talk about two particular areas, if I might, not all the points that Representative Olson introduced you. First, I want to talk a little bit about growers. The ability of growers currently is to grow for up to 4 patients, and because a patient can have 6 mature plants at any time, a grower can grow up to 24 mature plants and 18 immature plants for each person that they grow for, that they are grow site for. And just talking the mature plants, 24 plants is a sizable amount of marijuana. These can be very large operations. And as I talk to my community and I talk to individuals, I'm going to say I talk to people who, I used to be the young one in the group, now I'm the old one in the group, but I talk about them and I ask them to think about a marijuana plant. And almost without exception, the community views marijuana plants as what they grew up with, what they went to college with, what they saw in garages and in backyards, and what they saw in closets as they were going to college, where many of them who have not continued to use marijuana, where many of them were exposed to marijuana. The marijuana plants that we talk about today are nothing like that. This picture is taken, and I have to give credit to Raphael. I had a copy of this from another presentation. This is a picture of a marijuana plant at a medical marijuana grow. The man in the picture is 6'3". The plant just to the left there is over 15 feet high. We have taken down plants in Yamhill County with a trunk diameter in excess of 3 inches. These plants, I know there was some scoffing at the amount of taking pounds off of plants, but literally these plants yield significant amounts of usable marijuana. The detective here, if you look at his arm, is holding just one, I hesitate to call it a stem, branch that shows the bud on that one branch. That's just one bud on a single plant, and you'll note that it is as large as his arm. One bud, and you can see the size of the plant behind him. My point is this. I think what the community viewed when they talked about growing marijuana for the purposes of individuals using marijuana for medical purposes clearly did not envision what we have today. Every single day in this state, law enforcement encounters operations like this, and it's not what the community envisioned when they passed this law in 1998. However, again, it does not. I am not for a moment taking the position here that there are not legitimate uses. These are abuses of the system, and we need to rein in the number of people who can be with a grower and how much they can grow. We're not dealing with the number of plants per patient in this bill. That's not what we're talking about. This bill would allow information to be with the Oregon State Police, and I ostensibly, I think, would allow law enforcement additional information about a particular grow site. I can tell you that our law enforcement in my county, and as far as I know, law enforcement throughout the state, when they get a report or find a grow site, the very first thing they do is attempt to authenticate that it is a legitimate grow site. The last thing they want to do is enter somebody's home, take down a door, and then find out it's a legitimate grow site. The problem is this. They may ultimately find out that a grow site, there is a legitimate grow site. OMMP says, yes, that's listed as a grow site for X number of cardholders. But having no information about the cardholders, and in fact, I think this deputy DA who does this a lot more than I, Raphael, will tell you, go in and find the cardholders. 3 of them could be dead. 3 of them alive. Mm-hmm. And so these are old card registrations at our particular grow site. That's an unlawful site.
If you could
Brad.
Speed it up?
Wrap it up, because I want to try to give even amount of time.
Absolutely. So. I wanted to talk just ever so briefly then about caregivers. The current law provides that a person can be a caregiver for as many patients as there are. And the abuses here are also rampant. I just challenge you to go to Craigslist in Portland, and you see individuals advertising to become a caregiver for a cardholder. The original proposal of caregivers is someone who takes care of someone who is sick. Currently, though, you could have 100 cardholders and be a caregiver and have the ability to hold 24 ounces of marijuana for each and every cardholder for which you're a registered caregiver. Again, this bill would limit it 1-to-1. I think the original intent, you're a person caring for a person who is sick and aiding them in their ability to live a comfortable life. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Raphael?
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, and other members of the committee. My name is Raphael Casso. I'm the Major Narcotics Prosecutor out of Josephine County, Oregon, and a Deputy DA with the Josephine County District Attorney's Office. I want to briefly talk to you about the amendments that I'm reading on here with regards to Oregon medical marijuana and the victimization of the patients that are a party to, or many of the patients that are a party to the Oregon medical marijuana program. As DA Brad Berry was talking about, the photograph with the marijuana plant being above 15 feet tall, that individual was an Oregon medical marijuana grower. He was victimizing his patients. His patients, he would give them 1.5 pounds of marijuana. He bragged, and we got to that site because he sold 10 pounds of marijuana to an out-of-state individual that got stopped in a traffic stop. We went back to his house. He bragged that he got that 10 pounds of marijuana off one of his plants. He had other patients. I routinely talk to innocent patients in all of this that want to get their medical marijuana because their growers are not giving them their medical marijuana. They're having to go out to other locations to trade with other patients to get their medical marijuana because these growers that are abusing the system are finding that they can sell medical marijuana back east, back in Minnesota, for $6,000 to $9,000 a pound. When, as that individual was bragging, he was getting 10 pounds off of each plant. That's a $60,000 to $90,000 plant that he has there. He had 60 medical marijuana plants on his grow site. So if you do the quick math, I believe that's $3.6 million, but I'm not a mathematician. Those are the abuses that we are seeing. Routinely, we see individuals that are caregivers for 10 individuals. They're driving down the road with 15 pounds of marijuana. When they get stopped by the Oregon State Police or by Grants Pass Department of Public Safety, the SO department, they indicate that they're on their way to deliver their marijuana to their patients. When those officers contact the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, they cannot get the name of the patients for that caregiver. So they have no way of verifying if that person is delivering his marijuana to those patients. Oftentimes, what we're finding down the road when we can get hold of those patients is that they were not getting marijuana delivered to them. So that caregiver and that grower are selling that patient's marijuana for profit, and the patients are being injured in this whole program. As I was reading through the amendments to this, the making the five-year moratorium on someone who is convicted of manufacture or delivery of a controlled substance, an A or B felony, and then lifetime for those convicted twice of that. That makes sense, because those people that are abusing the system are the ones that are getting convictions. And we do not want to re-victimize those patients over and over and over again by having their growers committing felonies and dealing their marijuana to other people. That amendment makes sense. Additionally, the amendment with regards to the caregivers, and the same story with regards to the moratorium of them being a caregiver for five and lifetime. That makes sense. Again, those are people who are abusing the system, not the innocent patient that is using their medicine as prescribed. Those are key issues. When we have marijuana plants that are giving 10 pounds off of each plant, 2 pounds for a inefficient grower, that's enough marijuana for a person for a year. There's no need to grow 6 mature plants and have that grower have that temptation of 85 or 88.5 extra pounds of marijuana sitting at their house with nothing to do with it. That's where a lot of these folks are getting into problems. I have individuals who have been convicted of manufacture and delivery of controlled substances who were just in that scenario. And they tell me that when they have 88 pounds sitting there in excess after they've given their patient their medicine, what are they going to do with it? Destroy it? No. They're going to sell it in Josephine County for $1,500 to $2,500 a pound. They're going to ship it back east for $6,000 to $9,000 a pound. Those are the abuses. And that's why I'm here today, is to talk about the abuses to this program, which are widespread. With regards to the Rogue Area Drug Enforcement Team, 99% of... 99% of our complaints are about medical marijuana abuses and grow sites. Approximately 70% of my caseload is marijuana cases, and of those 70%, 95% would be medical marijuana abuses. And that's a huge problem when we have patients that are suffering. Thank you.
Members, any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm trying to understand what the difference is between the situation we have now with law enforcement and the situation we had back before medical marijuana. When I was prosecuting cases, what you had to prove is that somebody had possession of it. It was in the county on the day that you specified in the document that you filed with the court. That was about it. What do you have to prove now in order to get a conviction?
If I may. Now, for the first thing you have to look at, and again, Rafael Casa, Josephine County District Attorney's Office, the first thing you have to look at is the patient a medical marijuana card holder? If they are a medical marijuana card holder, they can possess up to 1.5 pounds of usable marijuana at any one given time, plus 6 mature plants and 18 juvenile plants. That's what they could possess at any one time. So that's the first thing you look at. Then, as the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program statutes are sitting, there's an affirmative defense that even if someone is not a cardholder, if they are otherwise complying with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, if they have seen a doctor within one calendar year prior to the arrest date, if they are within limits, if they are using it for the medical marijuana, for the purposes of medical marijuana, that is also an affirmative defense. So even if they don't have a card, there's a loophole built into the medical marijuana statutes. So these are all roadblocks that we run into. The inability to find out how many patients or the names of patients that a caregiver has, the names of patients that a grower has, that limits our ability to prosecute a case. And those are all roadblocks that we have to go through in the prosecution.
Yeah. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
What does this bill change that removes any or all of those roadblocks?
One of the roadblocks that this changes is that it lowers the amount of folks that a grower can grow for, thus eliminate or lowering the quantities that a person can have and the temptations that they would have to sell the medical marijuana of the innocent patient. By creating the depository that would allow law enforcement to check for grow sites, that will eliminate some of that ability to hide behind that for those people that are doing this unlawfully. If you're following the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, there should be no problem. So those are the big things. It removes a few of the roadblocks by creating a depository where we can check if a place is a lawful grow site, how many, and those locations are released. It was to the Oregon State Police, but it may be to OMMP, that we can check into that depository. That is one of the things that it does.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
Thanks. I just had a quick question about the scale of this, I guess. So how many investigations are done statewide on medical marijuana card holders?
I don't have the numbers for the entire state. We're a small agency. We're a 4-detective team with a supervisor. And the percentages that we deal with are... the majority of cases, as Rafael Casa was saying, are medical marijuana grow sites. We have, as he stated, over 90% of all drug tips that we get are complaints from citizens who are extremely angry about about marijuana growing in their neighborhood. We check to see if they are. We confirm that it's a legal growing site. Unless we have other information, we have to move on. You can drive down Redwood Highway. You can drive out to Kilmer Road. You can drive out in Williams, and you can see the telltale signs of the big fences with plastic up above that, 9 or 10 feet, and you know that's a growth site. You can call in and check that that's a growth site. But it's just, it's too much for us to investigate all, but I can tell you the percentages of what we deal with in our drug team is the majority of it is marijuana, because those are the complaints and tips that we're getting. We still deal with mushrooms, LSD, methamphetamine, other things like that, but we have to tell citizens, I'm sorry, you know, they'll complain about, it's a, also a livability issue, they'll complain about the stench that's coming and they can't go out in their yard, on their porch, they can't enjoy the evening because the neighbor is growing medical marijuana on the other side of the fence, 10 feet from their patio, and they get angry and they call us, and then we look into it, and if we see that they're in compliance, we tell them there's nothing we can do. So I guess I don't have the numbers, but I can tell you it's in the majority of the problems that we have with the medical marijuana program and our complaints.
Just a quick follow-up, and I know you probably don't have that information, but I was just kind of looking for a perspective of, you know, of the medical marijuana grow sites that are, you know, registered that you investigate, what percentage end up in, you know, violations that are prosecuted.
Good.
And Representative Holvey, if I can address that. Generally speaking, when our Rogue Area Drug Enforcement Team investigates and gets past the initial stage, usually what we're finding is almost 100% of the grow sites that are investigated past the initial stage are out of compliance. Through our agency and through our department, if someone is just over one plant, we're not going to file a case on that. We're jerking one plant, getting them into compliance, and we're going from there. But what we're finding is that there's large-scale deliveries associated with it, hugely out of compliance by several hundred pounds of marijuana, hundreds of plants over, that type of stuff. 90% of the calls that we get are out-of-compliance growers. So this year alone so far, we've already filed over 300 cases in Josephine County with regards to out-of-compliance and medical marijuana violations, which that's a four-man drug team, and that's a one prosecutor for major crime, major narcotics crimes, and that's a huge number. But like I'm saying, that is not everybody. There are lots of people that are following the rules with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program.
Thanks.
Okay. Representative Freeman?
Hold off. I know you got a lot to get through.
Okay. Representative Berger?
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. Would somebody please explain to me the difference between a cardholder, a caregiver, and a grower, and how they interact? Because I never quite got that, and what the legal, what those three things legally are.
Representative Berger, Rafael Casso, Joe County DA's office. A grow, medical marijuana cardholder is a patient with a debilitating medical condition under OMMP that is licensed or authorized to use medical marijuana for their condition. A grower is a person who is authorized to grow medical marijuana for that patient. And then a caregiver is a middleman that, or a middle person that can, that is the designated primary caregiver for a patient. They are supposed to be responsible for the primary care of that patient and can possess up to 1.5 pounds of marijuana for their patient.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up just
follow up?
So under current law, a caregiver, there is no limit to how many patients they could, but the grower can only grow for four.
That's correct. A grower can grow for four cardholders, but what we see is co-ops of growers. We have grow sites in Josephine.
Okay, I got to go quick. So, okay, yes. So let me get the numbers right. But a caregiver could have, there is no limit, and are they registered, and are the, with anybody, and the names of who they're caregiving for registered with anybody?
They are designated by their patient, and they can have an unlimited number of patients. We've seen above 10, 20, 30 patients to a single caregiver.
And does this bill change that?
I don't believe so.
Well, it changes the caregiver.
Excuse me, Chair, Co-Chair Olson and Hunt and Representative Berger. Yes, it does. It limits the ability to one patient to one caregiver.
Thank you. Thank you.
Could I add one thing? Could I add one thing in regards to that? May I add one thing?
Go ahead.
In regards to the caregiver, in our investigations, especially with the large co-ops, we have patients who have never met their grower, nor have they ever met their caregiver, nor do they ever meet their caregiver or their grower. And the caregiver can be used, for lack of a better word, as a mule to transport marijuana for sales, and the patient goes to the grower or goes and is delivered the marijuana by someone else. I mean, it's the caregiver situation is really a problem in this whole organization of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
And the next panel, Andrew, did you want to come up with all? Okay. So Andrew Meyer, Leland Berger, Jose Garza, Jennifer, she just stepped out. We'll catch her when she comes in. Jennifer Alexander and Bob Wolf. And just for all of you who are here on House Bill 2256, that's being held over to Monday, May 23rd. House Bill 2573 is being moved to May 23rd. And House Bill 3659 is also being moved over to May 23rd, Monday. The last two is because we don't have a fiscal, and the first one is we haven't received additional amendments yet. So, did you want to go first, Andrew?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrew Meyer, Legislative Director of the...
And Andrew, I know originally I said we were going to go just till 10. I'm going to just go till 20 after.
Thank you. Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon here in opposition. I'll testify and then move away so the other folks can come. And I just wanted to clarify a few things and make a few statements about the larger issues. I know there was talk about a work group, and I think there's two kinds of work groups in this building. And for purposes of this bill, ACLU, which helped draft the original law, was not part of the work group. As I said, we were involved in drafting the law, and the language was very carefully done. And I believe voters understood that the dynamics of medical marijuana was evolving with medical conditions because of the failure of our government to actually allow it to be prescribed. We are limited in that way. But there was a specific rationale of putting it with the Oregon Health Authority rather than the Board of Pharmacy or the State Police. And that's one of the things that the Oregon Health Authority does is handles public health information carefully and confidentiality because they are able to get that. And when you start adding law enforcement into that authority more and more, I think we get very concerned that it begins to undermine the trust of folks giving information to the Oregon Health Authority. The current law has appropriate access, we think, for law enforcement. Briefly on the change with the therapeutic value language that's being amended in the Dash 1s. Basically, the Dash 1s define therapeutic value the same way the current law is already written about mitigate the symptoms or effects of the person's debilitating medical condition. But it changes the doctor saying it may mitigate to the doctor having to say it will mitigate. And I don't think that's possible for physicians to do. I don't think they can ever say a medication will mitigate for that particular patient. Imposing such a requirement in the context of medical marijuana would result in deterring doctors and making it very difficult and interfering with the patient. With all due respect, as I think we all know, law enforcement has always opposed the Oregon medical marijuana, and I think we'll continue to do so. And I think what we should need to work on is changing the federal government policy regarding the controlled substance scheduling of marijuana for purposes of use for medical purposes. Thank you.
Okay. You need to leave.
No, I'm happy to stay. I just have others.
Okay, any questions of Andrea? Representative Freeman?
Thank you, thank you, Chair. I think I heard you say this. You think the current medical marijuana program is what the voters intended and what you worked on when you helped put the law together?
Co-chairs, Representative Freeman, to be first of all clear, I didn't. ACLU did. I wasn't around then. Two, I was specifically referring to the issues around the types of use for medical conditions, because I think it's often talked about that the voter pamphlets were, it's for this limited cancer, this limited situation. And specifically, I think it is evolving. There's actually studies regarding veterans, and maybe someone I believe will be testifying in post-traumatic stress disorder and the use of medical marijuana. I think it's an evolving issue. And I think voters understood that, but we can all disagree or agree on that and other things related to this. I want to let the other folks who are more involved in the very specific of the operation of the program speak.
Okay, I just, ACLU helped start this thing. That was part of your testimony.
You kind of made it
sound like it's working just the way you all intended it to, so if that's what you're saying, I just wanted to hear that.
Co-chairs, Representative Freeman, it's not worked the way they intend to. I can talk about how difficult it is for patients who don't know how to grow medical marijuana and find someone to provide the medical marijuana, but again, I think other folks will do it. You know, ACLU has policies on drug reform. We'll leave that to another day for a larger discussion.
Thank you.
Let's see. Bob, do you want to go next, then?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, just a moment. Jennifer, you want to close up with this panel, right?
That's fine.
Okay, thanks. Okay, Bob.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, and members of the committee, I always appreciate being able to participate in this kind of testimony.
If you'd identify yourself, Bob.
Hmm?
If you'd identify yourself.
Robert Wolf. I'm with the Oregon Marijuana Policy Initiative. We're a coalition of a dozen major patient and advocacy groups devoted to defending the medical marijuana program in this legislative session. This legislature could have taken strong steps to deal with real drug problems in our state. We could have gone after cartels that grow on public lands. We could have gone after gangs that import drugs and cook meth. We could have addressed trafficking and prescription drugs, and we did not. Instead, we chose to go after medical marijuana patients, sick people, poor people, disabled people, sometimes dying people. These are the people that pay fees, that fill out paperwork, that give you their address, that try hard to comply with a relatively complex regulatory system. I call this the low-hanging fruit syndrome. They can't get away. Why are we attacking them? It's not that there aren't problems with medical marijuana, but there are no legitimate studies, reports, or surveys to back up these anecdotes of abuse. I think what the officers and law enforcement officials are describing are problems with the black market. The black market is much bigger than the medical marijuana program, and I don't believe this bill addresses the black market problems whatsoever. In fact, I will tell you that the marijuana genie is out of the bottle in terms of the black market, and you guys, the legislature, doesn't have the resources, the political will, or the social mandate to even go after it in any significant way. And I think the result is we're picking on medical marijuana patients because they're easy to get to. This bill was crafted outside of the process of obtaining public input, particularly no input from the affected constituency. During the work group process, I offered expert testimony on any aspect of medical marijuana so that the legislators would be up to speed on all the information they needed. I was rebuffed. I offered a series of proposals to improve OMA on behalf of the patients, and those ideas were ignored. And what we ended up with is a bill that instead finds ways to limit patient access to the program, to punish law-abiding citizens already enrolled in the program, and that allows law enforcement greater leeway to use the database to conduct warrantless visits and to go on fishing expeditions without cause. I want to let you know that if you use this bill to kick people out of the program, you will not stop their use of medical marijuana at all. Instead, you will create criminals out of people who are currently law-abiding citizens. With about 40,000 patients in the system, it's actually underutilized. If you take everybody in Oregon that has a qualifying condition, AIDS, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, gout, glaucoma, and so on, there could be hundreds of thousands of people who could qualify for this program and who might find benefit from the therapeutic use of medical marijuana. The fact is, our side is failing miserably to inform patients in need about this effective, low-cost treatment option. That said, if you want some factual and documented abuse of the program, not just anecdotes and scary pictures, look no further than law enforcement incursions into the patient registry. This supposed confidential database actually is subject to a huge number of queries by law enforcement. According to information provided by the medical marijuana program staff,
after a long delay and many prevarications, it showed that there were more than 51,000 queries to the database for a one-year period ending in September 2010. And that figure is only queries made through the database. There are also a huge number of queries made over the phone that are recorded manually by program staff and kept in three-ring binders. We don't know how many there are. They won't count them for us, but it is tens of thousands. The theoretical high estimate of the total number of queries in the database during that one-year period could be as much as 100,000 queries on the database. I think this is outrageous. Law enforcement is only supposed to hit the database if necessary to verify cardholder status. Were there actually 100,000 investigations into criminal behavior involving marijuana last year? I don't buy it. The pattern of database access is not proportionate to population overall or to patient cardholder population in any county or geographical area. As a matter of fact, the county with the greatest degree of hits on the database without justification is Marion County. Josephine County is up there, though. These numbers prove a broad systematic abuse of the database access by some law enforcement agencies, primarily county sheriff organizations, and I believe it is a poor allocation of law enforcement resources and a clear abrogation of law enforcement responsibility to pursue real crimes. The result of all this sound and fury, 60 people were kicked out of the medical marijuana program in 2010 for violating the law. 60 after potentially 100,000 database hits. Members of the committee, this is a bill that would not be good for the citizens of Oregon. It gives them no benefit. It would only criminalize harmless medical marijuana users. It would give law enforcement tacit permission to continue and even expand their vigilante or non-lawful access of the medical marijuana database. And again, the anecdotes I heard describe the black market, and I don't believe that this bill would do anything to stop that black market. I urge you to table this bill and allow it to die. Thank you very much. Again, I really appreciate participating.
Okay, thank you. Jose, do you want to, or Leland, which one of you want to go next?
I'm prepared. Thank you, okay. Co-Chair Holson.
Yeah, if you want to move that a little bit closer to you, that'd be great,
my
Leland.
My name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I practice statewide representing, including both Yamhill and Josephine counties, representing patients and their providers. I've been practicing since 1983, and I've focused my practice on this area for about the last 15 years. I helped I helped draft the Medical Marijuana Act in 98, and although I opposed it in its final form, I assisted in the drafting of Senate Bill 1085 in 2005. I'm also, I think, the person responsible for estimating initially that there would be 500 patients, and what that was about is that there was, and you know, the thing of it is, Medical Marijuana Act or not, people are going to use cannabis therapeutically because it is a non-toxic herbal remedy. That's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about plutonium. We're not talking about some huge public risk substance. We're not talking about methamphetamine or cocaine or anything. We're talking about medical cannabis. Anyway, there was, before the Medical Marijuana Act, a dispensary in Portland called the Alternative Health Center. When the police raided it, there were 350 people that were a part of that group. I extrapolated that to suggest that in 1998 there would likely be 500 patients statewide. As my colleague Mr. Wolf explained, you know, only a small percentage of those with the listed conditions, the estimate is around 9%. If everybody in Oregon who qualified for the Medical Marijuana Act registered under the Medical Marijuana Act, there'd be 400,000 or 500,000 patients instead of 40,000 patients. So actually, the number is low. And I did, Co-Chair, also want to correct that the people in Montana didn't repeal the Medical Marijuana Act. There's some political dynamics in Montana that have to do with the Tea Party and a governor that they don't appreciate, and there was the legislature tried to repeal
right,
it.
That's
really what happened. So, and Mr. Wolf mentioned about 60, because Representative, I can't remember who it was, asked about how many people were arrested and prosecuted. The last time that question was asked in a legislative session was in 2002, and in that year the number given was 12, or 4 a year over the first 4 years of the program. The reason why there was this laughter about, and you should see the plants that got away, kind of laughter. You know, is that last session or the session before Sheriff Mike Winters from Jackson County, each time he talked about the plants in Jackson County, they got bigger, and it was like, you should have seen the plants that got away. And the fact is that there are lots of patients that are and growers who aren't able to cultivate at all. In my friend Rafael Caso's county, you know, it's the climate is what the sign says when you go into Grants Pass, and it's true that that's some of the largest and best medical cannabis in the world is cultivated in southern Oregon. That's just a fact. But the problem isn't that there's a lot of marijuana. The problem is that there isn't a regulated supply system. And we, as a community, tried to resolve that in the polls last fall by putting forward a really well-drafted regulated supply system, which unfortunately only gathered 43% of the votes. I don't think it's that the people don't want there to be a regulated supply system. I think that, frankly, I think it's not possible to pass that by an initiative. I think that that's what the legislature needs to work on. But if the legislature is really going to work on that, then the problem that Mr. Wolf identified exists. You can't have a meeting and not invite us to talk about how to resolve these problems, because we've been working on them for a long time. You can't also, I think, decide because some cops are unhappy with how many patients there are that we got to make it impossible for anybody to get a card. And really, functionally, when you change it to might mitigate to will mitigate, that's what you're doing. No physician says, well, you know, because for I'll give you an example. I take every morning. I take a thyroid pill. It's a hormone replacement thing. That's what I take. My physician didn't say, here, Lee, you know, we checked your blood test. You need this thyroid replacement pill because it will mitigate this problem. He said, well, we'll see what happens. You know, maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't work. If it's not working, maybe we'll increase the dose. Maybe we'll try something else. Functionally, Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt and members of the committee, if you change it from might mitigate to will mitigate, no one will be able to get a card in Oregon. And that's just wrong. I won a case today in the Oregon Supreme Court involving concealed handgun licenses. One of the abuses of the law is that sheriffs have been denying concealed handgun licenses to patients because they were patients, notwithstanding the fact that the law required them to do that. Judge Shively in Medford, Judge Price in Hillsborough, the Oregon Court of Appeals, and today the Oregon Supreme Court each said that the law requires sheriffs to issue concealed handgun licenses and to stop doing that. And then in the same way there's already been the abuses that Mr. Wolf described, you know, that's really the problem. I didn't see in the bill where it limits the number of persons a person can be a caregiver for. And I think the problem with the notion about just ascribing prior convictions to as an exclusion is that there are lots of reasons people could get prior convictions. I mean, you've heard about these cases in Josephine County. I've had two with Mr. Caso. One involved a guy who had the legal number of plants, but some of the immature plants got too tall. And the other involves some people who were visiting who the police said told them that they were helping to trim, and they said they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's not a good case to take to trial. So, I'm certain that there are these kinds of abuses, but, you know, I think what we need to do is look at it in the broader perspective, again, that Mr. Wolf describes. Nobody ever talks about how big a bite the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act takes out of the underground market. If there wasn't an Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, all of the medicine, all the medicinal cannabis that patients had and used would come from the underground market. Because we've legalized that for medical purposes, that's no longer a part of the underground market. If we want to end the excess medical marijuana that's produced from winding up in the underground market, then we need to create a licensed and regulated supply system. And I'd encourage you to do that instead. I had one last thing, if I could, really briefly. One case I lost had to do with out-of-state patients being able to register in the state. And as a consequence of losing that case, oddly enough, the law changed and we are able to. And the reason is that the Court of Appeals was concerned that about whether the requirements for being able to apply for a card interfered with a constitutional right to travel, kind of like the way the Heart of Atlanta Motel didn't used to let African-Americans stay there until the United States Supreme Court said they had to. It's unconscionable to deny out-of-state patients the right to travel in Oregon with their medicine, so long as they're within the limits of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. It's just wrong to allow the privilege to Oregonians and deny it to out-of-state patients. Currently, of the 17 states and the District of Columbia, this week Delaware allowed it, and Delaware statute includes post-traumatic stress syndrome. Montana and Rhode Island have reciprocity provisions. If you want to work on a reciprocity provision, I'm certainly willing to help with that. But please, just kill this bill. This is a bill that really shouldn't go anywhere, and that's the reason the other 20 haven't either. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jose?
My name is Jose Garza. I'm a veteran of the United States military. Again, you know, as everybody else has said, thank you for the opportunity for me to come speak. A couple of points that I'd like to hit on. It sounds like people have hit the will provide medical treatment and stuff like that. To me, it sounds, again, ridiculous. To say that something absolutely will do something, as ex-military, I can't tell you if we launch a mortar round that it absolutely will hit its target. That's why we launched 5. Okay? I do want to, you know, thank you guys for listening in on the other people who have come in and changing the whole 3-month thing to 6 months. 6 months still seems a little bit much, just from the fact of there are a lot of families out there who don't have medical coverage, who don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, and to be able to come up with the $300, $400, $500 each and every visit to go in front of a doctor, have them sign this, and all of that. Is a little unfair for those families because that's an extra expense on the youth. I personally can't see, as a father, any family using their child as the mule, their sick child as a mule, so they can have marijuana in their house. So to really make them check more, it just doesn't really seem fair to me. The rules for the lead system. On a personal basis, I must say that I do agree that in some instances, law enforcement needs a way to verify the guy that they just pulled over. He has an ounce sitting next to him. Is he on the program? We got to know for real. Okay, I understand that. But to continually hand them a list every 3-4 months, every quarter, greatly jeopardizes the safety of each and every individual that is on the program. I'm aware that there's a county in the state of Oregon, I can't tell you which one, that published where they believe all of the medical marijuana grows to be.
Washington County.
Anyway, apologize for that. I know that in my grow alone, I've never charged a patient for a thing. I'm in a position, a very unique position in our community, of being able to take on patients who can't afford their medications, who can't afford the equipment to go in. Now, I've got well over $10,000, $12,000 in mine. A lot of these people can't afford that. So they come to somebody like me and say, look, I need my meds. Can you grow them for me? Well, and again, to touch on something new, the limit, the grow amount for people from 4 cards to 2. Well, the 4 people that I have, one is myself, one is my soon-to-be wife, one is a very good friend of mine who she's on housing, she's on Section 8 in Oregon Health Plan. She can't afford $100, $200 an ounce, so here you go. And another one is another person down here in Salem who, again, is going to college and spending every dime she's got to go to that. So here's your meds. To limit it down would, yes, limit the amount of meds that could be grown in one location, but would also limit the ability for certain patients to acquire the medication they need. One of the gentlemen who was sitting up here referred to, you don't know if it's 6 plants, 60 plants, or 6,000. There's one very, very easy way to check that. Stand outside on the corner and feel if there's 60,000 plants worth of heat coming out of that house, because that takes an unimaginable amount of light. I'm running 10,000 watts. I've got under 100 plants, but just about there. 60,000 plants, 60 plants, you can really tell when the grows are out of place. The very poor grower creating 2 pounds per plant. I am considered a low-end to medium grower. I'm coming up on a harvest. It's the largest harvest I've had yet. I'm hoping for a pound. I'm going to cut down 18 plants. 18. Not one of them is even slightly close to a pound. These kind of numbers come from the people who will veg a plant and put it outside and grow it for a year. 1 year's plant, yes, can yield 15 pounds. But that's for an entire year of that one plant. The way I grow is a perpetual grow. So I'm lucky to get 2, 3, 4 ounces from each plant. And it still takes me 6 months from the beginning to the end to grow that plant. So 2 pounds per plant, I just wanted to clarify that. I would be in heaven if I could reach that. My patients could have what they need. The last point that I'd like to touch on is PTSD. I've touched on it before. I would sit here as a veteran, as a man, as a father, and I am absolutely begging you guys, at some point in time, can we please, please put PTSD on here? I have it. I got it real bad. Okay? I smoke my cannabis. I take it. I eat it. I take RSO. It's a Rick Simpson oil. I do my regimen. And again, as I said to you before, I'm able to fit back into my community. But that Rick Simpson oil that I take, 1 gram in the morning and 1 gram at lunch, takes roughly 5 to 6 ounces of a complete plant to make 1 gram of usable Rick Simpson oil in its complete form. So 16 grams will net you 10 grams of medicine.
Okay.
So thank you for hearing me.
Okay, thanks, Jose. Okay, we're going to end this at 4:30. So, Jennifer, if you want to come up, and if you got a little extra room then that I can invite some additional testimony up.
So I'm going to try and talk really fast while she's pulling this up. I just want to say
if you'd identify yourself, Jennifer, that'd be great.
I'm Jennifer Alexander. I'm a patient activist. I'm working on the campaign to legalize marijuana for all adults in Oregon right now, and just involved in general with different groups. Like I said, really quick, I don't believe that there should be any requirement for 21 and older, if I heard correctly, where we're moving it for caregivers but not for growers. I think that adults are subject to the same criminal penalties regardless of whether they're 18, 19, 20, 21. There's no reason to withhold that if they're going to be subject to criminal penalties anyway. National background checks, I'm not sure that those are necessary. I understand where you guys are going with that. If that is necessary, I don't think that should fall on patients whatsoever. I have a few ideas which I've presented in my written testimony being handed out now as to how we could possibly make that more reasonable. Since I am short on time, I'll let you guys read that part. Requiring patients to be Oregon residents, we addressed slightly, but to be very clear, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act is not something extra. It's a protection that we deemed necessary for sick people who use marijuana. It shouldn't matter where they live. That's all I have to say about that one.
Okay.
The will versus may, we've covered well. Minors, I agree with Jose 100%. We're putting additional burdens on those children who are already, we're talking 50 out of 50,000 patients are minors. That's 0.1% of these are minors. I know for a fact that there are not a bunch of doctors, parents, and children conspiring together. Maybe one or two, but you guys are basically looking at penalizing the other 48. So I disagree with that. Those are sick people that need every penny they can to put towards their health care right now, especially. The final one that provides a list of gross sites to police. This is where I want to put my biggest focus. This really, really bothers me. And as I explained to you the other day when I met with you, I respect law enforcement. I always have, and I hope I always will. But I'm really disturbed by the things that I've seen as related to this medical marijuana program and how the database is used by law enforcement. So before I jump into my PowerPoint, I heard something a minute ago from the three fellows that were sitting here that really, really disturbs me. They said that when they get a call or a complaint that somebody is growing marijuana, their first step is the database. Absolutely not. That is not how it should be. That database is to verify that I am a valid user. Until they have proof that I have marijuana, they shouldn't be touching that database. My neighbor calling is not proof. There is no reason they should be touching that database until they see me with marijuana in my hand. They pull me over. They're getting a search warrant at that point. I could be mistaken, but I don't think a call from my neighbor is caused for a search warrant. I think they need more than that. And I think that that's the problem that we're having with the way the law enforcement is using this. They're going to it first. No, that's my private confidential information. You don't go there first. You go there when there's a need to verify that I am a valid cardholder. At that point, there should be marijuana cardholder, and I say, I'm a patient. I'm protected. And the cop should go look. Yes, you are. And be on his way. That's not the way that they're using it, though. So that's to go into our PowerPoint slide here. Thanks to Russ Belleville, Christine McGarvin, Russell Gold, and quite a few other people, we were able to put this together. It's been an ongoing work in process. About the last week or so, we finally got a key to the ORI IDs, which are the agency IDs for each agency that's accessing the OMMP database. Before that, we had a bunch of numbers that we really couldn't make sense of. So this was perfect timing. How do I advance through it? Do I just...
Right arrow.
Just the arrow? Okay. So the OMMA specifically says, as I was just addressing, that you can only access the database to verify cardholder status. Verification implies that you have some reason to believe that they need to verify it. It's not to check if they might be a cardholder. And that they may not release or use the information for any other purpose. On that note, I've given you guys a whole bundle of information that I hope you all take some serious time to look through, especially if you do consider moving forward with this bill, illustrating quite a few abuses of law enforcement, including Washington County, as Lee Berger said, who issued a map of the investigations in their county that were related to OMMP. Now, these were not convictions. These were investigations. So these people were innocent until proven guilty. The OMMA should have still continued to protect that confidentiality and until there was a conviction. At the point of a conviction, I could see them saying, we've convicted this many patients that were out of compliance. But that's, again, not what they're doing. When they released that map, Sergeant Thompson of Washington County, spokesperson there, said, we are going with the state advises. He considered ORS 475331 advice, not the law. In Polk County, and it's also included in your packet, they listed the address, the name, the fact that this fellow was over his limit, and then they concluded the media release by saying that they left his wife, also a patient, at home with her three children after they confiscated her guns with a user amount of marijuana. So now they have her address. They know she's got a pound and a half of marijuana, three kids, and no guns. That really disturbed me, and that's actually why I'm sitting here today. That made me so mad as a mother and a patient that was put out there in the media as I put into the paperwork that you guys have. I call that a sitting duck. They might as well have directed the criminals to our house, and that offends me on all levels. Washington County, Douglas County, Jackson County, all of these have been involved in the various concealed handgun licenses. I've put the Held v. Hanlon case in your packet there, which the court found that it was a violation of the OMMP to go digging for background checks, and the Douglas County Sheriff openly admitted to doing so, and that's relevant for the data we're going to get to in a minute. And then the final thing is that there's a lot of anecdotal things that I can't prove to you, but I'm hoping what I've just given to you is enough proof in that packet. But there's people that get knocks on their door and they're asked to do a compliance check. They want to come count their plants by law enforcement. Or they'll get stopped at a traffic stop and the first thing out of the police officer's mouth will be, can I see your OMMP card, before they've ever claimed to be a patient or grower. We're going to have four charts here really quick. The first one is going to show the LEDS
Yeah, I just want you to know, Jennifer, we're
almost
done at 4:30 then.
The first one's going to show the number of the off-hours one. The second one is going to show them by patient population. Then the third one is going to show them by drug crimes, which is the other aspect of that. And then the final one is going to compare all three of those factors. So when you look at the chart here, the three red ones are the ones with the lowest number of patient populations per 1,000 individuals. And you guys all have a copy of this in your folder to look at in more detail later, because I knew I'd be short on time. The three red ones are the lowest patient populations. As you can see, Washington County is one of those, and Washington County is one of the ones that's always going on about the abuse and the growing and things like that, Sheriff Rob Gordon, et cetera. The dark green one down there, Josephine County, is one of the highest patient populations. Still, it's less than 4% of the population. The light green and the yellow are the different variations between there. And as I said, you guys have those exact numbers spelled out in that data table there where you can look at them closer later. But I want to spend more time on these next ones. This is the LEDS access per patient. And so what we're looking at here is Marion County is the highest access, even though if you look at this little chart over here, it's that same color code we were just looking at as far as the patient population. Marion County is one of the lower, it's not the lowest, but it's one of the lower end of patient populations, yet they're hitting the database the most. You can look at Yamhill, Polk, and Benton County, which were well in the lowest, and they're also hitting that quite a bit. So then we move on to per drug crimes. Okay, so they're hitting the database. There's not a lot of patients. We presume these are all illegal grows. There should be crime rates to go with this. We find that that's not true. As a matter of fact, in these dark red areas, and ignore Wheeler County because it's an outlier, there was 10 LEDSs and one crime. So that one's a little bit obscure. The rest of them are much more relative, and as I said, the data's there. But as you're looking, Marion County, Curry County, those are 5 LEDS database checks, you know, for the OMMP cardholders per drug crime. To be very clear, these drug crimes are not marijuana crimes. These are drug crimes, all drug crimes. Another further statistic to throw in here that the officers earlier did not know, and I do, is how many marijuana arrests there are per year. I don't know how many of them are OMMP, but I do know how many total there are, according to the data also in your packet, 239 per year in 239 per month is the average for the year of 2008, 299 per month is the average for 2009. That works out to be at most 3,600 for the year. If you look at this total on this page here, 23,000 drug crimes. So these LEDS hits aren't even related to marijuana in most cases, and we're still seeing a 5-to-1 ratio where they're not finding drugs. They're not finding illegal activity with the marijuana, and they're not finding problems with the patients either. This final graph, I think, is the most illustrative. And what you're looking at here is everybody that had a greater than 100% ratio to patients, cardholders, versus LEDS access. So if it was less than 1%, they were left off just because it would have been a very messy chart. The bottom is the LEDS access per patient in those counties. The side there is LEDS per reported drug crimes, and as I said, that's all drug crimes. Multnomah County is the big, huge ball there. The size of that ball is relative to the population of cardholders. And that way you've got all three of those factors in one graph. The ones I'm most concerned about personally, although I think they're all a concern, is the blue one up there, the yellow one, the green one, and these other ones that are drifting out. What you're seeing here, like with this big yellow one, for example, is that there were 5 LEDS OMMP accesses per patient in that county and 5 accesses per drug crime in that county. If they're not a patient and it's not a drug crime, what was it? That's a lot of accesses that aren't accounted as either one of those. So there's clearly stuff going on with a couple of these counties, Washington County and Douglas County and places like that. We know they're using them as background checks. This is wrapping it up. Okay. They're using them as background checks. Knowing that, that makes a lot of those other ones look a lot worse, because if we know that they're paying it inappropriately, and some of these other counties have even higher numbers, like Marion County, that we don't know if they're using it as background checks, we really, really cannot trust law enforcement to oversee this themselves. I spoke with you the other day about imposing penalties. I'd like to see that happen if law enforcement misuses the database. No list to law enforcement whatsoever. We need to strict oversight of watching them. Mm-hmm. And I also agree with the supply problem thing, which is probably something better for you guys to be spending your time focusing on right now, because it's not crime, it's helping patients. It just so happens we call it a crime today. Thank you.
Okay. be quick. Good. I don't think so, Jennifer.
I know you were close
that,
up.
That was really
so
good.
I was just jumping up.
That's, wow, you did a lot better than Monday's morning time we had. Wow. Okay. I greatly appreciate all of you today coming in like this. I just want to take a moment. Some of you, you know, have heard me share this before. This is an area that I do have some concern with, but I have really grown in understanding or trying to understand what's going on here as well. And I mean, and that's with 29 years with state police. Especially this last summer when I stumbled onto an individual that, and I think, Bob, I may have shared this with you, I don't know, that was suffering from MS. And he needed to have medical marijuana twice a day in his life. What I am stunned at how much that saved him on prescription drugs. So, I mean, but, you know, I just want you to know I'm trying to be conscientious of what's going on here as well. We greatly appreciate you coming in. If you have written testimony that you would like to share with us, please, we're going to be open to receive that till noon tomorrow, Jim.
Anytime tomorrow is fine. We'll put it on the record. We'll have it on the record under this bill and on this date. You'll see it posted to the Internet on the committee's webpage, and we'll put anything on there that we get anytime tomorrow or today.
Thank you very much. So we close the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3664. And do we have... Let me get going and I'll come out and see you guys. We'll just wait for a little mess here. I did.
I think that we had a couple of representatives.
I've
got Wally over here. Wally's over here.
Which one's Wally? Oh, Wally is...
That might be quick, HGR 44.
HGR 44, okay.
Everything has to be delivered.
Excuse me.
We'll do HGR 44.
Thanks.
I think it'll be really fast.
Okay, we're all here for the Constitution. Please.
That's the only one I hear that made it fast.
Pardon me, Cheryl. That's the materials I'll be submitting.
Okay, yeah, that'll be good.
I signed up as a neutral. I hope to be able to testify today.
Why don't you let's get together and talk.
So I'm not helped by these folks.
We gotta get okay, thanks.
I want so my contact information will be forthcoming.
Okay.
Did you sign open before? You got a big banner.
Yeah.
They didn't have it up when I walked into
it. You didn't see it?
You've got six members here. You've got Representative Hicks here.
Okay.
I think Winston's there. Go for it, right?
Great.
Okay, you're still on.
Representative Winston is here.
Okay, I'm going to open up a work session. If you could be quiet and just leave. Thank you.
Quiet and lead.
Quiet and lead, yes. Okay. Thanks. I'm going to open up a work session on HJR 44.
Mr. Chairman, HJR 44, you heard on the 28th of March, upon approval by voters at the 2012 general election, changes the terminology in the Oregon Constitution from legislative department to legislative branch, the executive department to executive branch, judicial department to judicial branch. It makes related terminology changes.
Motion?
Yeah, like, it could have a motion.
Yeah, I'm happy to make a motion.
No. Yes, if you'd make a motion. Oh, you want to make, okay, thanks.
Charles, I would move HJR 44 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
With a due adopt.
Due adopt, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. Representative Freeman moves the HJR 44 to the House floor with a due adopt. Yes.
Discussion.
Discussion?
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, Representative.
If I recall, this is a constitutional amendment.
Yes.
Referral. And what it basically does is change the name from department to branch. Does it do anything else?
That's it. If you recall, we had Chief Justice come in. And
oh, I remember.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I would say if you look at it, it's very, very short. You can see a few changes on there that do not have to do with the branch versus department, but they're all like changing the spelling of independent. It's currently spelled A-N-T, and it would change to E-N-T. It does make some apparently unrelated changes.
Well, legislative council cleans up stuff whenever they get an amendment. I understand that. But the only substantive change, if you can call it that, is to change the term from department to branch, isn't it? And spelling error correction. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you would call that a substantive change, yes.
Well, and if I can, and as part of the discussion, I think it's perfectly reasonable for us to bring all kinds of constitutional amendment proposals, but to actually refer this to the ballot for a vote on the basis of that issue seems like a significant expense to me for no real change. I understand why there may be some concern about the terminology, but we've lived with it for a long time, and I'm concerned about cluttering the ballot with something that actually has no substance to it.
Okay.
And I'm a no.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. Seeing none, Amy, you want to call the roll, please?
Member?
Excused.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Yes.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. HGR 44 passes. And I take it then, Representative Hicks, you want to carry that then?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Close the work session on HGR 44 and open a work session on House Bill 3658. Almost there. There you are.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3658, you heard this one on May 18th, which was yesterday. It directs the Adjutant General to form a commission of five individuals to develop and name a Medal of Honor, a Medal to Honor, the Oregon's fallen military members. It directs that the commission membership, in addition to the Adjutant General, be two Assistant Adjutant Generals and two Veteran Service Officers. The reason I laughed over saying Medal of Honor is because that was the title of the of a predecessor bill, and this takes care of that problem, allows this to be named something that the committee will determine.
Mr. Chair? Chair Hunt?
I move House Bill 3658 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Chair Hunt moves House Bill 3658 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Are we on 3658?
Yes.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Excused.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. House Bill 3658 passes. And let's see, I think Representative Witt. That be good? Okay. I'm going to close a work session on 3658 and open a public hearing and a possible work session on House Bill 2894.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2894 started out to be the companion bill for HGR 11. You have the -3 amendment, which replaces the measure. It requires communications that cost $2,000 or more supporting or opposing a candidate to disclose the names of the person or political committee that paid for the communication and a statement that the communication was authorized by that person or political committee. It specifies parameters of the required disclosure for written internet, audio, and video broadcast communications. It adds provisions to election campaign finance and regulation enforced by the Secretary of State.
Okay, Representative Kindler or Matthews, would you want to take a moment? Just so, Kettler, you want to start then?
Let me do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kettler, State Representative, District 39. I want to thank you for having this additional hearing. We appreciated the first hearing. This bill started out as a campaign expenditure limitation bill. Frankly, that was not well received in several quarters, and so we appreciate you allowing us to come back with the Dash 3 amendments. You should have been provided those. They are measures that provide for disclosure about who pays for different forms of campaign expenditures. I think these are sensible, transparent, accountability measures, and a great compromise. And I think others will talk to the specifics, and I think also the fact that it should hopefully meet constitutional muster. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee. I'll just put it there. For the record, Representative Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 in the Oregon Legislature. The Dash 3 amendments will do the following few things, then I'll turn it over to Representative Matthews and his aide, who can provide additional detail. It focuses on making sure the officer of record of any group that spends more than a certain amount, the current version of the bill is $2,000, of the Dash 3 amendments is $2,000, include their name and the group's business address, as well as a statement of support for the message in the campaign material. The materials should also include the names of the top three contributors to the group purchasing the campaign ad and those officers of record. And there are special rules for TV ads, radio ads, and exemption for lawn signs. So you don't have to put sort of a set of contributors on lawn signs, but where it's easy, like on a mail piece, you can. The Secretary of State, under how the amendment is contemplates, it will not perform spot checks, but will instead respond to complaints using current enforcement. And so their office says the current proposal does not generate a fiscal impact. I think us taking this somewhat modest, but I think somewhat meaningful step towards greater disclosure will help democracy a little bit. And I urge your support, and we'll turn it over to the good representative Matthews.
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, and members of the committee. Truly an honor. My name is Greg Matthews, for the record. It truly is, Representative. Greg Matthews, Representative from House District 50, great city of Gresham, here today on House Bill 2894 and the Dash 3 amendments. As you have heard, they're somewhat of a gut and stuff, and the relating clause allowed us to do that. This bill really does get at something that I think voters are ready for, which is transparency in documentation, things that go out. As an example, we use myself as an example in some of the literature that we've talked about with some of you individually. And that would be basically that, if someone were to run, paid for by the Friends of Greg Matthews, it would show my P.O. box in Gresham, my address there, but also top donors. And in my case, actually, last election cycle, top three donors were the Portland Metro Firefighters, Future PAC, and the AGC Committee for Action. And that would give their officers a record. The importance of that is, quite honestly, I think if somebody were to run against, and I'm going to be blatantly honest, I'm in a swing district. I am sure somebody will run a piece that will say Greg Matthews is whatever, worst guy in the world, paid for by mom, dad, and your brother. And if they do, I think it's fair that they come out and do that. I think for far too long and too many times, people have enjoyed being in the shadows of these elections, throwing these punches out of left field and having no accountability and no name on it. And quite honestly, I believe the voters are ready to change it. I know that I am. And I think that we've come up with a compromise here that actually gets us to there. It's a step that I think is necessary. It's one that I think is called for and one that will be supported. I think, we have bipartisan support here on the panel, but we're also looking for that out of the legislative body because, quite honestly, I think the voters deserve better in their mailbox. And I think the pieces that go out should at least have names associated with who's responsible. To my right is Derek Bradley. He is legislative aide out of our office. Derek has worked a tremendous amount of hours on this issue. He's got some technical experience and expertise. I would like him to briefly summarize some of those points, and if you have any questions beyond that, he might actually, out of this panel, be the one to answer those. So, without further ado,
we're happy to stay here.
The great work of
sit here.
Yeah, but actually, the great work of Derek Bradley. I think it's worth noting how much time he's put into it, and I'm awfully proud of the work he's done.
Charles and Chair Hunt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Derek Bradley. I'm legislative assistant to State Representative Greg Matthews, who represents the wonderful people of House District 50. The Dash 3 amendments to 2894, as Representative Smith put it, will provide some disclosure to the voters regarding who is funding various campaign materials that one might find. I have a couple points that I wanted to touch on is that a lot of the nitty-gritty details on this are based on a bill that passed in Connecticut last year with strong bipartisan support. There were, I believe, 10 no's in their House and unanimous vote in the Senate. We've worked a lot with agencies and lawyers to discuss the road forward for campaign finance reform in this state, and something that we have come across is that there are a lot of questions about what is and is not allowed in Oregon Constitution regarding campaign finance reform. We used to actually have in the state of Oregon a similar law, somewhat different than what we're proposing, regarding disclaimers and disclosures on campaign materials. And after the first Van Atta decision in the 90s, the Attorney General issued an opinion saying that they felt that sort of disallowed such action, you know, basically disallowed campaign finance reform bills in this state. The Van Atta decision, however, takes a step back from that, and reading from that decision, I would just like to, I quote, the first court statement in Van Atta 1 that campaign contributions were constitutionally protected forms of expression, regardless of the ultimate use to which the contribution is put, was unnecessary to the court's holding. On further reflection, we conclude that observation was too broad and must be withdrawn. Taking that into consideration, I've discussed with all three of the representatives to my left that we feel this is the natural step for campaign finance reform in Oregon. This is something we had done that then was sort of overturned, and the court has sort of said maybe we were a little too broad. We've discussed it with agencies and lawyers that feel that this is the, if you're going to take a step forward with campaign contribution or campaign finance reform, this is the natural step, and we feel that it is worth it for the voters to try and provide them with a little more clarity as to who's funding all these mail pieces they get in their mailboxes. This is not a partisan issue. This is an issue that we think is just great for the voters, and I would be happy to answer any questions about specifics. One line of statement is that, you know, I think a lot of what people are after is making sure that there's no corruption or even appearance of corruption among their elected officials, and they want to know who's funding these things and how they're getting out there. And thank you for your time and consideration of this bill.
Derek, your representative has spoken quite highly of you for what you've done on this. So, see, Representative Freeman, you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Two quick questions. One is Section 2, Number 7, Subsection 7, it's page 4, line 1, where you list out lawn signs, pins, or other similar items. Some of us that don't live in the big city use things called field signs. Is that meant to be part of this list? Or a field sign would have to have the disclosure and what you're describing on it?
Yeah. Our intent is that no. The idea would be that, you know, as it mentions also, the size of the font would be size 8 font, and personally, I'm driving down highways.
Just asking, because that is clearly could be construed as something different than a lawn sign.
And Chair Olson and Representative Freeman, that's a fair question, one that we didn't think about, but that's not our intent, that field sign would be the same as that lawn sign.
I have somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 of those is why I'm asking that I put up each election cycle. So,
well, you know, Representative, I try not to have any legislation that's going to impact you directly.
I certainly appreciate that. And the second question I have, if I may, quickly reading the amendments, what are the teeth? I mean, what is it if somebody violates this law? And who's going to take the time to figure it out?
When we were drafting, Chair Olson, members of the committee, when we were drafting these amendments, we initially were discussing, and Chair, Representative Freeman, excuse me, when we were drafting these amendments originally, we sat down with the Secretary of State and asked them, do we need to include teeth? In fact, that was the exact term we used. Do we need to include teeth in this bill? They reviewed the proposal, what we were discussing, and they said, no, we did not. Current law would allow them to enforce this on a complaint basis. So if someone filed a complaint, they already have the mechanisms in place to pursue and investigate that.
Quick follow-up. So if somebody doesn't do what it says in here, how does that go? Somebody just ignores it.
Chair Olson and Representative Freeman, the same as it goes now. You know, somebody files a complaint against your campaign for any reason, those get investigated. If they're unfounded, they're unfounded. You receive a letter of that. If not, then whatever the Secretary of State currently does within law, in some cases I think they have the ability to fine and penalize you that way. Of course, they're looking for compliance more so than anything else. So it would just fall under the current law and the current practice and the system as it is.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Berger.
Yeah, gentlemen, I like where you're going with this, and it's kind of part of our issues around transparency and informing people. One of the little problems I see here is that, I mean, we all go to our own PACs and say, as you said, Representative Matthews, what would it look like? And one of the things that bothers me is that a lot of us have maybe 20 donors who are all in that range, and some three get picked out to get their names in lights on a piece of advertising, which doesn't inform so much as it sort of picks who you're going to put in lights. And so one of the things that occurred to me that you might consider is we have, all of us, a very transparent internet-based system. So how about requiring that the language be something like, you know, this is paid for by this PAC or whatever, and to find a list of donors for the who have contributed this, please go to, and then a nail it web address for people to look at the whole list of donors to that group, which would take up less room, if you will, on your lawn sign or field sign, or I mean, I buy billboards, and that would take up a lot of room in a billboard for all that, you know, fine print. But because we have a very transparent system, I'm just asking, you might consider that. I like where you're going on the transparency thing, but this would give you some people a way to access everything.
Chair Olson and Representative Berger, I think it's a little hard to speak for three people, but I think we're amenable to suggestions. We chose this because, and we did actually have some discussion about some other ways to do this, just because it seemed a very simple, straightforward, easy way. But the reality is, over the course of your campaign, those names might change.
Right.
And I think we'd be open to it if that made a difference in this passage.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, and Representative Berger, it did come up. In fact, you'll hear from Mr. Sal Peralta here in a little bit. And that was a conversation we had on whether or not we could just put the link to your OrStar account as an example, and if that were required. And again, if that's what the committee would desire, then we wouldn't have an objection to that. But the conversation we had actually went around how many people would actually take the time to plug in the www.lookwheregregmatthewsgetshismoney fund. But there again, it doesn't mean that you should exclude it in a transparency effort. So your point's well taken.
If I may add, I think the other piece of that discussion also was the issue that how well will people navigate that system that aren't familiar with CNE reports?
Well,
follow up.
That would maybe encourage it to be more navigable if more people were accessing it, and if there were some links, it would, and people were frequently going to it, it might encourage sort of better accessibility issues to come forward on it. People are getting very internet savvy. I haven't mastered Facebook yet, but when I do, I know I can master OrStar.
Coach Olson,
for Vice Chair, Representative Berger. Again, without speaking for the gathered hordes, I think that there probably, my hunch would be there would be interest in exploring that, but I would at least argue that we do it as in addition rather than instead, and I'll offer why. I agree with you that it might improve and increase traffic to Orstar, and that could be good, and that might encourage Orstar to, you know, be sort of more like a 2011 thing rather than not. The reason I would suggest that we not do it instead is related to what Representative Matthews said. There is actually data that shows that people don't move from TV to internet very well. Like if you said, go to my website on a TV ad, they don't do it very much. If you go, say, on the radio to the internet, they don't do it very much. If you do it mail to the internet, they don't do it very much. Internet to the internet, they do it a lot. Right, so the thought was for analog communications, right? This is particularly designed to mail pieces, right? Not field signs, not lawn signs, particularly mail pieces. That it's less likely that, you know, all of us hope they don't just go from eyeball to garbage. We sort of assume they do. Likelihood of eyeball to computer to garbage, you know, not as likely as putting it on there. So my hope we'd consider doing in addition rather than instead.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Wingard, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I want to bring your attention to Section 2, Lines 6 through 8. The tricky part about campaign finance laws is trying to craft them in a way that doesn't allow a giant hole for somebody to walk through and avoid what you're trying to accomplish. So you're suggesting this language that if the communication cost more than $2,000, then the bill kicks in. Cable ads cost about $50 each. So I might make a $20,000 cable buy, but each individual ad could be well under that threshold. So I'd ask you to think about whether you're, that $2,000 threshold is really kicking in. I'll give you another example. So I could do a mailing to 10,000 people, and it might cost me, with postage, $6,000, but it's costing me 50 cents per household, right? So if I, in my mind, believe that the communication with the voter was 50 cents, I'm well under your threshold. So I think you're going to have to be clear about what that $2,000 threshold really means and when it kicks in.
Mr. Chair and Representative, let me take the first shot at that. I guess I would go back to the reference of a mailing piece. The cost of mailing that and processing it is somewhere between 60 and 98 cents, roughly. So if we used your analogy, it wouldn't be necessary on that. I think communication is the buy. What we do is we report on our CNEs the total cost of the purchase. So when you buy $20,000 worth of $50 ads, you report $20,000. You've exceeded the $2,000 threshold. Same thing's true when you do an $8,000 mailing. It's exceeded the $2,000. I don't know. Maybe others have other thoughts.
Chair Olson and Representative Wingard. It is, first of all, the Connecticut law sort of navigates around that and sort of addresses that. But it's there for the limit is there for a reason. It's to make it palatable to federal law. There was a case, 1995, I believe, McIntyre versus Ohio State Elections Commission, I believe, is the Ohio State.
I hope you're right. I want to check that right now.
That says that you have to provide some form of floor or ceiling to still allow anonymous campaigning. And I believe it's the same case that sort of precludes us from including ballot measures or any issue-based campaigns in this law, which is why we're focusing on candidates. There needs to be an ability to convey anonymous political speech. And so that's there, though it is a good point that we need to be clear in rulemaking or subsequent amendments that we're talking about the buy, the total purchase of communication versus an individual ad. And so the immediate thing is, well, I'll just make sure I just buy. Some might decide to buy small hunks then, but you're not going to get the bulk discount then. It's going to cost your campaign more to do that, and that is a decision you might have to make. Hide my donors or get the bulk discount.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, and speaking also to the record, comes down to the definition of communication, whether the communication is, we mean an individual mail piece or an individual ad, or the mail piece, the ad. And I think it's good to clarify the intent of the bill, that the definition of communication is not each individual iteration, but is the communication itself. Right. So the only way to avoid it would be a lot of little different communications, where a lot of different TV ads. And at some point, and the judgment was that at about $2,000, it becomes the common practice. You'd have to be working pretty hard to get around it if you wanted to buy $1,999 communications and then change it every time for above that. And by the time you did that, that itself would look silly enough that it might be notable and newsworthy and not be a very good political tool. So I think your point is well taken. It's very helpful to clarify on the record the definition of communication should be the that not each iteration, but an entire communication, that run of mail piece or that run of advertisement.
Yeah, you can make it.
Well, thank you. I just want to piggyback on something that Representative Berger said. You know, if my top donor is a $1,000 donor, but I have 25 of them, what will the mechanism be for choosing who the three are that that get placed on the mailing? And I think you need to think that through, because I think especially when you're talking about big donors, they tend to be round numbers, $5,000, $10,000, $2,500, something like that. And it is more than conceivable that a PAC's top donors may be well more than three people who have given some kind of top round amount like $2,500 or $5,000.
Chair Olson, Representative Wingard, another point of topic that came up in the discussions, you know, if you have three donors, if you have 10 donors that have all, you're fortunate enough to have all given you $10,000 to your campaign, I don't think anyone here has an issue with you choosing who you would be most comfortable showing to the public as your donors. I found in researching Representative Matthews' election cycles that while donations tend to be round, there's a number of in-kind donations or small little contributions that are added, especially with big donors that are longtime supporters through the campaign, that to my surprise, because I expected that to be the case, led to there not being as many same donor values for large donors as I thought there would have been.
Representative Freeman, you just want to follow up?
Yeah, thank you. And this is sort of on top of a question that was asked earlier. So we'll use an example again from outside the big city where we don't spend near the money you all spend. And it's no trade secret that when we produce our pieces, sometimes we use them for handing out of the door, and then what's left we mail. So in my case, or in cases in smaller areas, we might produce 10,000 pieces and then mail whatever we don't get handed out. But my question is, if I produce those pieces in September to start handing out, my top donors will be a certain group of people. By the time I mail them 10 months later, my top might be a different three people. How would that work?
At the time of printing.
At the time of printing. Does it say that in here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Freeman, we had a little bit of discussion, and I'll turn it over to Derek to add further. The way that we thought it might be sufficient to say at time printing, put that in the legislative record if the committee thinks an amendment to that order to clarify time is necessary. I would certainly have no objection, but I'll turn it over to our Master of Ceremonies, Mr. Bradley.
Chair Olson, Representative Freeman, this is more discussion, a discussion I had at length actually with the LC lawyer, who very capable, Gina Zeljic, who has done a lot of work on this for us. It does say in Section 2, Subsection 1C, it's actually page 1, line 19, current election cycle to date. And in addition, we went through the process of the LC lawyer and I went through the process of discussing, should we try and define point of purchase or how to do that? And she said that would actually probably create a lot of problems with this bill, because it would require us to reinsert what point of purchase meant and start defining that in a number of other instances where purchases are being made, campaign contributions are being made. So we just added at time of purchase to the date. And so it is included, and it was discussed, should we be more specific, she thought, and I agree that it would have been a needless complication to the...
But to be clear, you're buying the printed materials at one point in time, and you're buying the postage and the mailing and the communication at a different point of time. There's clearly two purchases there, and that's...
So, if we could just kind of wind this down, it's obvious we're having a little bit of...
I like the idea of what you're doing.
I don't think that should hold us up for a moment, and I'll say why. If we keep the definition of communication similar, right, the definition of communication is not the handout of the iteration. The definition of communication is the production of the thing, right? Then whether you mail it out, if you buy your piece, and then you mail a bunch of them, you still got 400 left, and that's what you're going to use your walk piece for the remaining 2 months, you don't need to change it, because the definition of communication was that production, right? So I don't think that should hold us up. I think the current language may be better than an alternative, and I'll turn it over to others if they want to say different. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the interest of keeping it short, I think there's several people who want to testify, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, what I'm going to do is close the work session. Public hearing right now on 2894, a possible work session. I'm going to reopen it here in a little bit. And right now I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3654.
House Bill 3654 authorizes siting of a winery on land zoned for exclusive use as forest or mixed farm and forest. It authorizes a winery so sited to sell wine, cider, or malt beverages and other food and beverages incidental to the retail sale of wine. It authorizes the operator of farm or winery so sited to hold up to 12 commercial events per year to promote agricultural products if the event is registered with the county, with identification of provisions to be made for traffic, parking, sanitation, and other needs of the event's attendees. It applies provisions to wineries that produce between 150,000 gallons and 250,000 gallons of wine in 2010, authorizing current use to continue without requirement of a permit, and declares emergency effective upon passage.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Berger, Representative Holvey. Smaller group now, so it's easy to address everybody.
Just your hands.
I'll try and be brief, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jim Squared here. There's probably three or four different winery bills. I think all of us were here last session when we had the issue of the pumpkin and Cinderella and the wineries all being thrown under the bus, and we tried to find a resolution, and we didn't find a resolution, so we extended it into the next pumpkin turning into a pumpkin on December 31st of this year, and so we're back. And actually floating out there right now, still moving, is 3654, which we're going to talk about briefly, SB 829, which is relating to wineries, which is a key point here I'm going to come back to. And then we have House Bill 3280 over on our side, which is related to EFU. Let me say again, EFU, not related to wineries, related to EFU. And there's actually some discussion of a pretty decent gut and stuff from the Winery Association on that bill, but again, it's related to EFU. And I see Representative Berger over there is catching on very quickly to what I'm saying here, and that's because wineries, strangely enough, in the Willamette Valley, and in the new redistricting terminology, we have all these American viticulture areas where these wineries sit, which ironically is an old ATF term, alcohol, tobacco, and farms. The federal government has bloody thing to do with agriculture, but federal government decided to name all these little areas. And funny enough, wineries grow good on slopes. And a lot of crops don't grow real good on slopes. And so we have wineries that are in EFU, and we've spent a whole lot of time talking about that for two sessions. But in my Senate district, which has five counties, and Representative Thompson's 24th House District, 23rd House District, and Representative Widener's 23rd House District, we have a lot of hills. And so most of our wineries are in farm forest. On forest land or on what's called mixed-use lands, which all came out of our good friends, Thousand Friends, 10 years ago or 20 years ago when we cut the line and had to make up with stuff. And so the relating cause really matters how you're going to do something. And so the EFU side of the house has been kind of hammered out, and there's some pretty good discussions going on out there in this session about that. But the other half of the wineries, more than 20 wineries in my Senate district, are not in the plan because they are in farm forest land. I actually have an LC opinion request downstairs. Can we stuff farm forest and mixed into the EFU? And all of you know what happens when you send things down to the Legislative Council. Who knows what's going to come up? So having said that, in a minute I'm going to let Jim kind of walk through 3654, which we asked for you to provide a hearing for, because the relating clause might be quite useful when we finally come up with a conclusion of what we need to do, because it is going to turn into a pumpkin before we come back in February, and we are going to have to fix this session in some manner. A couple quick things that do come up that I should point out. I have five counties in my district, and it's the counties that came to me. So as you always hear, you know, the Associated Oregon County position is X, or this county position is that, and of course not everybody's on the same sheet of music all the time, and so this bill actually came out of a request from the counties, and it's been circulated amongst more than 20 wineries in my district, actually some in representing Berger's district and some of the other districts, representing Olson's district too. So the issue is, you know, we have the farm forest thing. The other thing that I just want to throw out there to remind everybody that I normally do, and Representative Hunt always gets a grin out of this because everybody starts talking EFU and save farmland, the federal government can't balance the budget, so they're talking about cutting the federal farm program. And in the state of Oregon, we pay for 500,000 acres of prime farmland not to be planted. Let me say that again. In the state of Oregon, the federal government pays for 500,000 acres of farmland not to be planted. And according to Katie Koba and the Agriculture Department, we still have 500,000 acres of fallow property besides that. So there's a lot of farmland out there. And what we really need to do is just kind of come to a solution finally on the wineries, because we know they're here. We need them for economic development. And we've got to address not only the EFU that's out there that some of these other bills do, but the forest properties. So with that, I'm going to let Jim Square kind of explain the bill and go from there.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Olson, members of the committee, my name is Jim Williams. Jim Squared comes because I'm the second Jim in Representative Thompson's office. For the record, I am the legislative director for Representative Thompson of the 23rd District. The 23rd District covers all of Polk County, parts of Benton County, Marion County, and Lynn County. There are over 50 wineries and vineyards within our district. And that is the other wine bills that Senator Boquist has mentioned only address wineries and on EFU lands. 3654 addresses specifically wineries on mixed farm and forest use lands, and that is the key difference of this legislation. The provisions of the other legislation do not provide or apply to the mixed farm and farm forest wineries. That is the reason for this bill. Some people think that may be good. Some people maybe think that may be bad. I would like to call your attention in the handout to an editorial that the Oregonian put forward on May 8th, calling for a new direction in policy for an important state industry. 3654 authorizes vineyards, wineries, and their associated activities on lands zoned for mixed farm and forest use. Conversations with legislative council, the relating clause on the other legislation will not allow those two zone lands on it. Other differences within the bill is that 3654 requires a license from the Liquor Control Board to be an outright permitted use. That is to go ahead and get around the issue of a lot of small wineries planting a few grapes and calling themselves a winery for the purpose of a lot of events on it. To be eligible for food service, you have to be an outright permitted use. And you also have to produce more than 100,000 gallons per year on that. Activities are allowed up to 12, but those activities are regulated by the county. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to just close, if you wouldn't mind, and give my apologies. I mean, I headed the work group during the last session that was supposed to resolve this issue, and as I said, we had to come up with Cinderella and the pumpkin coach because we could not come to a conclusion last time around, and we ended up simply extending a moratorium out that said that counties couldn't take actions against these wires until December 31st. So regardless, that problem is out there, and again, Mr. Chair, the problem lies both with EFU and with farm forest and with forest wineries. And so if we end up passing only an EFU bill, we're still going to have those same wineries facing the same retribution or the same problems come December 31st of this year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Hovey, did you have a question?
Well, just I'm well aware of a lot of the winery bills around, to say the least, and I appreciate this, and I do recognize that a couple of the bills are about wineries in EFU land, but there's actually a couple others that are a little bit broader than that as well. So I'd love to talk to you probably a little bit more about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Holtby. Yeah, we just need to find a solution. I think everybody has a legitimate point. I mean, you and I both know about the one we're both in favor of fixing, and the challenge is you know, how do we get something in the right relating clause and get our lawyers to agree to it?
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing and work session temporarily on House Bill 3654, and I am going to open a public hearing and a work session on House Bill 3661.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3661. It regulates the activities of persons who prepare, present, or prosecute veterans benefit claims. It limits the fee to 20% of past due benefit amounts obtained. It requires claims on behalf of an Oregon resident to be filed in Oregon, and it declares an emergency, this time effective September 1st, 2011.
Okay. Jim Wallace is not here. Representative Esquivel, you are planning on testifying on this. Okay. Okay. I will close a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3661 and reopen public hearing and work session on House Bill 2894. So we have four people who have signed up. Sal Peralta, you want to come up? Janice Thompson. And actually, there's four, so you might as well all come on up. It looks like you're all on the same side there anyway. So Dan Meek, and then is it Kelly?
Kathy Lynn.
Yeah, that's right. Excuse me. Thanks. Be a tough act for you to follow with the other four that were in front of you there, I mean, just a few minutes ago. Sal, if you want to go ahead and get started, that'd be fine.
Thank you, Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2894-3. I'm Secretary of the Independent Party of Oregon, and I'm testifying today on behalf of that organization. Our members recently identified this bill as a legislative priority for the party, with 81.4% of the members who participated in our legislative agenda process supporting passage of this legislation. The purpose of this legislation is to protect the free speech rights of individuals while providing voters with more information about the sources of campaign communications, including independent expenditures. I believe that this legislation will help reduce some of the negative campaigning that we've seen in recent years, and at the very least, it will give voters more information about who's behind these communications. It's consistent with Oregon's system of campaign finance reporting, which relies on disclosure rather than contribution limits. And I just have a couple of brief points to make. I think the legislators did a good job of addressing the bill. The legislation was drafted in a way to protect the rights of individuals to engage in anonymous political speech, such as leafleting, while ensuring that their committees and their major contributors and the leaders of some of the committees are held to account. It does not require disclosure of anything that the committees are not already required to disclose to the Secretary of State, and the Oregon State Supreme Court has recently upheld those reporting laws in State v. Moyers. I'm not going to take up any more of your time testifying on behalf of the bill. I think you've had ample testimony. Thanks for taking the time to hear the bill, and I would encourage you to give the bill a work session and send the bill to the floor.
Okay. Thank you. You guys want to trade seats there real quick then? think so.
Chairman Olson, my name is Dan Meek. I am appearing on behalf of Fair Elections Oregon, which is the organization that sponsored the most recent ballot measures concerning campaign finance reform in Oregon. I would point out, first of all, that Oregon did have political advertising disclosure and disclaimer requirements on for the ads themselves until the legislature repealed those in 2001 on the advice of the Attorney General, the then Attorney General. His rationale is based upon the U.S. Supreme Court case, McIntyre, that was mentioned earlier, where Mrs. McIntyre was putting leaflets under the windshield wipers at a school board meeting because she was opposed to a school bond measure. I argued, of course, against repeal of the disclaimer requirements in 2001. I think I might have been the only one. Because when it comes to commercial level advertisements that are that cost several thousand dollars, there isn't a personal privacy concern. Since then, several federal circuit courts have upheld disclaimer requirements in candidate campaigns. So I think the constitutional concerns that were raised by the Attorney General in 2001 have been resolved. In addition, in 2005. In Measure 47, Oregon voters enacted a similar system of taglines on independent expenditures. So Oregon voters are already on record supporting these sorts of disclosures in ads themselves. That measure required that spending on independent expenditures, I believe, over a threshold of $1,000, every ad had to state the name and primary business engaged in and amount contributed in this election cycle by the top five dominant contributors of $500 or more to the campaign. So voters have already expressed, I think, their opinion that this is a good idea. Just one response to Representative Wingard, who asks a very astute question about whether a communication is the whole buy or the communication is each individual, piece of communication going to individuals. In other states that have these requirements, they have language that says that a communication as a whole includes all substantially similar messages to different recipients. So it is intended to mean the whole buy. If you're producing a brochure, it's all the brochures taken together. It's not each individual brochure. If you're doing a mailing, it's the entire mailing taken together. And of course, if you're doing an ad on TV, radio, or elsewhere, it's the total ad buy. It's not the individual ad buy to run the ad once. And I think that's what the drafters here intended when they said in Section 2, Subsection 1, a communication in support of or in opposition to a clearly identified candidate that costs more than $2,000 in total. I think that is what that is intended to encompass. Thank you.
Jens?
Janice Thompson, Common Cause Oregon. Definitely support the bill as an important step in revisiting this issue of how Oregon is going to provide easy public access to disclosure of major campaign contributors, as well as letting the public know who is behind campaigns, candidate campaigns with a disclaimer, paid for, authorized by. As has been mentioned, the history on this is some of these features were in current law. I think this bill, which potentially could have been expanded, is an appropriate kind of piece to kind of revisit that topic. It's important to keep in mind the legal underpinning of all of these efforts relates to corruption or the perception of corruption. I think in Oregon we're lucky to not be viewed as having some problems as, compared to some places, other political jurisdictions that I will not name, but are oftentimes, the target of punchlines of jokes. But at the same time, I think it's important for us not to be naive, and just this is generally about people having the right to know. I've also thought about the issue about how this fits or doesn't fit with, having ORSTAR. But concur with some of the earlier legislative testimony that this isn't an either-or, and that there is a big difference between kind of what people could find online versus what, you know, is right on a piece of paper for them. And that's particularly true since you've got to do some manipulation in OrthoStar to really get the aggregate information. So it's not even just that you could go to OrthoStar and find the top donors. A couple of areas that I think the bill moves forward, you know, needs to be kind of just, reviewed and potentially reworked. One is the, contribution to date topic that has already been discussed. I think the earlier discussion kind of nailed down how to probably handle that, but there may well need to be a little bit more details in the bill, recognizing that, the Legislative Council is rightfully concerned about not having too many details. One quick point in a reference on page 3 of the amendments I have to a reference to a website. It would be good to make sure that there's a publicly accessible website. There is the discussion about de minimis value, and my recollection is that there's already in campaign finance reporting some discussions about, kind of de minimis. And so I think another vetting process would be like to just kind of double check how that terminology is already being used in law and to make sure that that kind of dovetails, and, if it doesn't dovetail, figure out why and if that makes sense, or make it dovetail. The whole officer of record does introduce kind of a new concept, and so I think, that should be really kind of, looked at in terms of, is it going to kind of meet the goal? It looks like it does, but I would be happy if it moves forward to kind of, be part of a discussion to zero in on that. And then finally, this whole definition of communication that's currently reflects state law does come from a case after the 96 elections that occurred under limits, the Crumpton v. Kiesling case. And it was really designed, and the decision in that case really put Oregon at the time in the forefront of not having kind of the artificial distinction between express advocacy and issue advocacy, with and to have the idea of communication be as broad as possible, so we wouldn't get into like, oh, that's not a campaign ad because it doesn't include the so-called magic words, for example. So that said, at the federal level and in many other states, how to deal with this distinction and breaking down kind of this any reasonable test, person, view of saying, come on, that maybe doesn't have the magic words, but obviously it's a campaign ad. There's been other work, and the term of art that's been in federal law is electioneering communications, about how to make sure that the communication definition really picks up everything that should reasonably be viewed as being a campaign communication. And so, given that we have this, some lessons we can learn from this federal discussion, I think another thing just to take a look at is to do some comparison between our law that reflects some litigation that may not reflect some of the more recent learnings from the federal area. And I think it's because if we're going to do this, we do want to make sure we don't end up with the situation where, oh, this doesn't apply to this, because even though any reasonable person looking at it would say that's a campaign ad, it doesn't quite meet, it doesn't include this, and so it doesn't get factored in. So I think it's just a recommendation to kind of make sure that that definition really is as comprehensive as people want it to be.
Okay. Thank you.
Happy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, we're left. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We don't have anything in Oregon except disclosure. and this bill moves into a good new direction for ensuring that we're going to have more disclosure. The issues of campaign financing have been really changed by the passage of Citizens United, because that's allowed hundreds of millions of dollars to be poured into political campaigns. And actually, that doesn't really contribute to the understanding of candidates and the issues. Candidates are marketed like toothpaste with little civil discussion of issues. More campaign money has not translated into better government or even better political campaigns. 2834-94, the Dash 3 amendments, which replaced the whole bill, are yet another attempt to bring out-of-control campaign finance system under control to benefit voters. This amendment would specifically require more disclosure in campaign advertising. There's very good detail about the disclosure as written for audio-visual, automatic dialing, brief audio, and de minimis value advertising. We particularly like the top three contributors requirement to some advertising. We strongly support this amendment, and we urge you to move it forward.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much, panel. I'm going to close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2894, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing and work session on 3654. We're going to try to get done by 6 tonight. We have basically 8 people who have signed up to testify on this bill, and we still have another bill that we need to we haven't had any conversation on at all, and there are 5 people who want to testify on that. So if we could move quickly through this testimony, I would greatly appreciate it. And let's see, first people up is Bob Simmons and Joseph. Okay. If you have written testimony, we'd appreciate that, and so you don't have to read that to us. And if you could just summarize, mm-hmm. We'd greatly appreciate that.
Representative Olson, my name is Bob Simmons. I live on Germantown Road, just outside of Portland. I purchased about 50 acres of land back in 1979, and not knowing what to do with it, I had the University of Oregon, the State University, come out and sample all the soil, do drillings, do all the things that they do. And when the gal finished, she said, plant grapes. So we started our first vineyard back in 1981. And it started out as a hobby, then it went to selling the grapes, and then it went to raising the grapes and sending them out to make our own wine. And now we're up to 16 acres of grapes, and we produce probably about 800 cases of wine a year. It's a very small winery. But it takes about 400 cases of us to pay for having somebody else to produce it. So we'd like to do it on our own property. We have a barn. We've got it fixed up for a winery. We have our federal license, OLCC license, growers privilege license, everything except that we're on exclusive forest use. I'm 72 years old. I have no desire to have parties, weddings, bands, restaurants, anything like that. All we really would like to do is raise grapes. And so we, obviously, I support 38, whatever the number is.
I'm Joseph Schaefer. I'm a land use planner at the Schwabe firm in Portland on behalf of Abbey Creek Vineyard, which is Bob's vineyard. We are in a forest zone and are precluded from even making the wine. And so I think it's important to understand that while there's a significant difference between farm use and mixed farm and forest use, there's a huge difference between forest use and farm and forest use. Because we're in a forest use zone, we can't even make the wine. I've suggested adding a phrase to carve out forest use from the other agritourism events. I got a copy through Jim Stembridge electronically yesterday. I don't know if you've seen it. But even if you haven't, the point I want to leave you with is, in a forest zone, you're allowed to have a vineyard, and do nothing except pick the grapes and ship them out. And our belief is that if you're able to have a vineyard, you ought to be able to make the wine. I'm sure you're going to hear in a few minutes from some people who will discourage allowing wineries to occur in a forest zone. And just will say one last time, we're not interested in events or agritourism, but we do think in a forest zone, someone who does have a vineyard ought to be able to make and bottle their own wine. Thank you.
One last comment. After seeing the crowd at the first hearing, I think I might start raising marijuana.
Thank you very much, Bob. Okay, next panel would be Art. Here, okay, Harry and Linda. I appreciate your time, too. Again, if you have written testimony, if you could just summarize.
Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I will try and be very brief at this point. The association, although I will say right now that I'm very sympathetic with the question and issue of wineries on other than EFU land, is not in support of the passage of this piece of legislation in its current form. There are issues at this point, and as you've heard earlier, there are a number of vehicles out there that address the winery issues at this point. And I've unfortunately been very involved, at least in reading all of those. There are subtleties between those. There are unintended consequences if you approve one and not the other. There are a lot of things in play. That being said, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Association of Oregon Counties, since the passage of Senate Bill 1055, has been involved in the issue of events and activities on farmland. And in fact, we have another bill, Senate Bill 960, that is in Senate rules that at one time had a winery component to it, because we had been working with representatives of the winery industry as well as state agencies and a number of counties on the issue of events and activities on farmland as well as wineries at this point. This is an issue that needs to take place. We need to take a pause to see if we can't pull things together. We've been trying to do this for all this year since this session happened, or it began. One of the major issues, and I just want to let you know, one of the major issues for counties is the question of food service, the question of restaurants, and the question of how food is prepared and provided to the public at this point. We have no problem with limited service restaurant provisions. We have no problem with food that may be required by law at this point. But we do have much concerns when we have and think that other food service at least ought to go through the land use process, permitting process, if it's going to take place, and we think that's a viable process. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'm going to excuse myself because my carpool is sitting there waiting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Harry? Chair, my name is the committee. My name is Harry DeBoer. I'm living in Washington County. HB 3654 contains some provisions that were also very common in the last year's bill, Senate Bill 1055, and several of the same bills, or similar bills that were presented this session. I'd like to specifically talk about the danger that is contained in changing from to an outright permit basis dictated by the state government when there are several problematic situations occurring at a county level. We've had the example living right next door to us, where there were two Washington County here vineyards that had events, multiple events, and were holding lots of events on their vineyards. They were doing that without any permits and without any winery equipment or facilities on their vineyards at all. The entire activity was growing the vine, the wine grapes, and then holding the events to basically make the money. It was kind of a reverse order. Washington County issued final notice to forbid them from having these events. but they could not enforce those because 1055 last year's bill would have outright permitted those events, activities from becoming actually legal, because they would have been permitted to become a winery with all the events that would have been coming as a result. They were not granted the outright permit because they did not even meet the requirements for SB 1055. But the emphasis, the onus of the proof of that, of combining those regulations from the county level and the state level, was put on the shoulders of the neighbors. And after spending a lot of money and two county hearings and one final LUBA appeal, which we got the result of just earlier this week, we are now temporarily at this kind of situation, and it seems like it's some time to hold a pause anyway. It seems to me that granting outright permits to those who have not operated within the rules and regulations of a county can cause tremendous problems. Unless a law can be tightly written and not allow unintended consequences, we're probably better off to not have a state law governing what has been regulated by the counties. By grouping too many grape growers together for a state law for the sake of consistency may allow event centers operators to seek loopholes and use them to attempt to justify holding activities that have rightfully not been permitted. And they have been told so, and if they get this outright permit, they would be able to do so. There are maybe some people that say that weddings will create some economic activity, but I don't believe that the vineyards actually create the weddings. If they don't are not being held at the vineyards, will probably be held someplace else. There may be some out-of-state couples who schedule a vineyard wedding, but I think we should first determine whether or not we want to jeopardize Oregon's land use traditions of protecting EFU or EFC lands to these very few. The area in this bill that is in particular a concern of mine is the change from the Oregon tradition is the allowance of wineries in exclusive forest use lands. Differentiation between EFU and EFC lands were made for a reason and should not be lightly abandoned.
Okay, I see you reading from your testimony. We do have that, and we can...
Okay.
Thank you.
This bill has outright permitting for 12 events, and that's outright permitting. One of the gentlemen who presented the bill mentioned that it was under control of the county.
Did you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Linda DeBoer.
Thank you.
Washington County. I'm sorry, Chair Olson. I'm trying to hurry. Forgot that part.
Yeah, if you could just, I mean, we have
yeah,
your,
and
we appreciate
I'm not
that.
Going to, I'm not okay. Going to read. But the 12 events of outright permitting mm-hmm. are not really under the control of the county. That would be a CUP, a conditional use permit. And it does say that these outright permits, permitting things have to meet just a few requirements. They're listed in the bill, like 100 set foot back or whatever not. But I just want to clear that up. That's not quite the case. But what I wrote my, I would like to hear a discussion of what incidental and subordinate is. The activities are supposed to be incidental and subordinate to the wine, and I would like to hear discussion of what that is. You can hear somebody say something out of one side of their mouth and then something else on the other. And I'd like to know, are weddings incidental and subordinate? And if yes, they are, then what type of wedding are you thinking of? A little gathering or a wedding with 300 people and PA system? But that needs to be discussed. The 12 events is really quite a high number when you think about Oregon. That's every Saturday night all summer, because we only have 3 months of summer. The facility next to us charges $6,000 just on a site fee, so that's $72,000 of site fee. I don't think that's incidental and subordinate. And then also... the idea that once you can have 12, it's really easy to slip in four more. That's $24,000. I think that there needs to be some mechanism for control, and it's kind of a give a mouse a cookie, they'll want a glass of milk situation. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate it. I have up next Steve McCoy, Michael Morrissey, and Dan Jarman, who they may not all want to come up together, but that's the way I called it.
Mr. Morrissey had to catch his carpool also, and he submitted written testimony.
Thank you. So if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair, I don't know who chair. Co-chairs, members of the committee. I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I just want to make some very brief points. First of all, SB 1055, which I think it was what the senator was talking about with the Cinderella and the pumpkin, actually does not sunset until 2013, until January of 2013. So there is another session to work on this. Mixed Farm and Forest has the same rules as EFU for wineries, and that's an OAR 660-006-0050 sub 2. So this is really, while the bill talks about forest and mixed farm and forest use, it would really only be important for forest use. As many people have already mentioned, there are other ways to get here, that there are SB 829, HB 3280, and then there's SB 960 that's also dealing with similar issues, and OWA is bringing a bill forward as well. One large concern of ours is that this removes the minimum acreage for wineries, so that anything that is permitted by OLCC as a winery, whether they produce wine or not, would be considered a winery under this bill and could do the things that are allowed under this bill, including, as Mr. Boer mentioned, food service and events. And the bill authorizes 12 events of any size, any duration, on every tract of AFU in the state as an outright permitted use, even if you are not a winery. And there is no county review. There is a application process, but the county does not get to review the application under this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. If you identify yourself for the record.
Members of the committee, my name is Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this bill. We would appreciate it if the committee did not take action on this bill. As others have noted, there's been lots of conversations happening and are happening now about the winery siting statute and activity and events at wineries and at other EFU lands. They're working their way through the process in other committees. This bill in particular makes significant changes to the winery siting statute that was established in 1989 to basically set the ground rules for wineries operating in the state of Oregon. As my friend Mr. McCoy has mentioned, it takes out, for instance, the gallonage and acreage requirements and does many other things in a way that the wine industry would not support at this time. I think that the idea that Senator Boquist and Representative Thompson have mentioned about wineries on forest lands is a very interesting idea that we would like to continue that conversation with in our year-long activities talking about this issue. Quite frankly, those issues were not raised. Obviously, there's a significant and important number of wineries that are operating in these lands, and we would like to learn more about it and work with the sponsors, have conversations with them in the interim. We weren't involved at all in the crafting of this legislation, but we would ask the sponsors work with us in the interim to talk about some of the issues raised with this legislation. Thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And seeing no questions at this time, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3654 and open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3656.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3656. It requires the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to cooperate with local, state, and federal agencies and private landowners in fish and wildlife management. It requires commission work and local governments to mitigate adverse economic impacts when adding to a list of threatened or endangered species?
Oh, I think I'll call up Sal Esquivel and Mark Johnson, state representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. This is a pretty simplistic change into the current law. We have a couple of words that make from may to shall and. The other thing that what this bill does is it requires the State Fish and Game, or DFW, to, when they put a species on the endangered list, that they're also to consult not only with the various departments, but also municipalities and counties to see if there's a dramatic economic effect on them. And if so, there is, then they're required to mitigate and work with the cities and the counties to try to work their way through this. This is just a communication bill more than anything, and it's something that I think that is very important, because if we're all on the same page, then we can all approach a problem if there is a problem, whereas in the past maybe we have or we haven't. I think ODFW has been very good about it, but this will require this, and it'll be a step that they would be required to work with the local people.
Thank you, Mr. Acting Chair, committee members. Mark Johnson, Representative, House District 52. Just a little background on why this bill is here before you in this committee. This bill was formerly known as House Bill 3511, and it had a full hearing in front of our House Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee some time ago. It was on the agenda in a work session environment, and I fully believe would have been passed out of that committee on that day, but that was that fateful Wednesday several weeks ago where numerous bills certainly suddenly kind of met untimely death in committee environment. So the proponents had done a lot of good work. We'd had a very substantial hearing on this bill. As I said, our committee had thoroughly vetted it. Since that time, it actually is a better bill. They've modified a little bit of the language, and I just want to point out that the stakeholders, as Representative Esquivel referenced ODFW, the counties have worked together on this process collaboratively. I believe you'll hear from them that none of them have any issues with the language and so forth. But again, it's just a very pragmatic bill to ensure that the agency consults with local cities and counties on any sort of effects that listing species could have upon them, and to find ways to mitigate any effects upon them. So with that, I think we have other testimony here, and we thank you for your time. Any questions for either of us? Thank you very much. Appreciate you sticking around this beautiful day to kick us off on this bill.
Public servants.
Next up, I have Doris Pinwell and Kurt Melcher. Good late afternoon or early evening. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. I'm going to go first.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Counties and the Community Renewable Energy Association, but most especially Judge Steve Grasty from Harney County. He was the instigator of this bill, and it started because of experiences we've had over the last year and even previously in trying to develop renewable energy resources in the places in Oregon where that can happen. We have been trying to work collaboratively with Fish and Wildlife and other entities in order to site respectfully these projects. And in the middle of all of this happening, the Department of Fish and Wildlife proposed some changes, strategies to endangered species, which has made it very difficult for us to do some of the siting in a timely way. So because of the experiences we've had, we thought that, and with the work we're doing now with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, we thought that the statute really ought to reflect a more collaborative way of working together to both protect the species as well as to assure communities that they can survive and develop or and in a way that makes everything possible. The terminology in the bill that's before you also talks about mitigation strategies, and what we mean there is that we hope that when a project of any type, not just renewable energy, but anything we're trying to do, you can work with the department and try to figure out how we can make the project work, maybe change some of the provisions of the project through our siting processes, but also do what we need to do to protect the species, which is what the Department of Fish and Wildlife does. I think it's a change in culture that we need to move toward, and that's why this bill has been sponsored. And I appreciate the co-sponsors of the bills to try to keep this bill moving forward. And I especially appreciate the Department of Fish and Wildlife working with us. Thank you.
If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Absolutely. Thank you. Vice Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And I'll be very brief. We did work with the bill sponsors and the proponents on the -2 amendments to House Bill 3511, which was, as Representative Johnson mentioned earlier, the original piece of legislation. There were -2 amendments to House Bill 3511, which we worked with the Association of Oregon Counties on to try and reduce the fiscal impact on the department, as well as some technical issues that we needed to address in the original bill. Those amendments are, in fact, entirely captured in this now current version of the bill, House Bill 3656. And off the top of my head, I can't remember if we've completed a fiscal on this bill yet or not, but it should be much reduced from the original bill.
Mr. Chairman, I have information on that. The fiscal came back from the fiscal office as a minimal fiscal on this bill.
And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Okay. Kurt? Doris?
It's fine.
So one quick question from here, and I know we're out of here, but Mr. Melcher, I have to take this opportunity to, when we're talking about mitigating impact to our species, trying to prevent them from becoming endangered, do you take into consideration the impacts of non-native species that that we have in the state of Oregon, and how we can work towards mitigating their impacts on these native species, and speaking specifically about some of the warm water fish that we have in the state of Oregon.
Chair Olson, Vice Chair Holvey, members of the committee, we most certainly do. In fact, after a listing is in place, be it federal or state listing, we develop a recovery plan. We address all the limiting factors that are impacting that particular species, whether they may be invasive species, or in some cases, for instance, in the Columbia River Basin, we're looking at native species that have impacts. Northern pike minnow, we've documented great impacts on juvenile salmon is in the Columbia Basin. Some avian predators, cormorants and Caspian terns, as well as marine mammal predators. And all of those are actually being addressed in that recovery context. So,
just a quick follow-up. Do you ever consider lifting the bag limit on smallmouth bass on the Umpqua?
Chair Olson, Co-Vice Chair Holvey, we've certainly looked at all the warm water species. We have a great warm water fishery contingent and constituency out there. We've looked at, and be happy to sit down with you and talk about the kind of the population dynamics between our predator and prey relationships. Done a lot of work on that, both in the Columbia Basin as well as some other
areas. Thanks. I look forward to that conversation.
Thanks.
Thank you. Margie Hoffman and Holly Jenkins. And Holly, thanks for why you stayed in here for this whole thing.
Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I'll be very quick. I'm here to testify on behalf of, my name is Margie Hoffman, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Renewable Northwest Project, which is an advocacy organization working to bring more renewable energy to Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. We're here to testify in support of House Bill 3656. Over the course, since we have started developing renewable energy in the state of Oregon, we've seen over $5.4 billion invested in both urban and rural communities throughout Oregon. In rural counties, they're able to use the money generated from the increase in the property tax to plug budget holes in education, public safety, and human services budget. And these are vital services, and especially in a time when we're experiencing the dramatic budget shortfall that we see. There are many legs of the stool that help facilitate renewable energy development. One is our incentive structure. Another is access to transmission. And the third is predictability and certainty in the siting process. We believe that this bill will bring more predictability and certainty into the siting process and provide the balance that we need. Eastern Oregon is a very big place. We can protect our natural resources. We can protect species. And we can continue to develop renewable energy projects. So just urge you to support House Bill 3656. I want to thank the sponsors and the committee. I know it's late in session, so I appreciate the opportunity to continue to work on this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Holly.
My name is Hanley Jenkins. I'm the Union County Planning Director, and I'm also one of the seven members of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. I'm here today representing Union County. I do support this bill, and I think the primary point that I want to leave you with is that counties are responsible for recognizing Goal 5 resources through their comprehensive land use plans. And as a part of that, we will be responsible for evaluating T&E species as they're inventoried and listed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we will be responsible for comparing those resources against conflicting uses and determining whether or not those resources should be protected. I'm going to leave you with just two reference points. The first is this last week, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been going around central and eastern Oregon with their sage-grouse map that identifies the sage-grouse resources that they've inventoried and identified out there in specifically core areas. They held a meeting in Baker City a couple days ago. Baker County and Union County were present at that meeting, and adjustments were made to those core maps as a result of the review between ODF&W representatives and the counties. Very valuable opportunity for local jurisdictions and the Resource Management Agency to have a conversation, recognizing that there are criteria for identifying these areas and local governments need to participate in that process. The second is, it's been a few weeks ago, a Natural Resource Agency department head came out with some staff members and worked with counties on energy development projects that were being considered in Northeast Oregon. And a comment that was provided a number of times was that Natural Resource Agency needed to be involved in the process often and that they wanted to be a participant at the table. And I guess from a local government's perspective, as ODF&W lists T&E species, we want to recognize that that's a two-way street. We want to be a participant at the table often and be a party to the process. And that's all we believe that this bill is allowing local governments to have a seat at the table. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, Hanley. Thank you very much for waiting around.
You bet.
Right. Okay, close a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3656 and carry that over to Monday the 23rd. And then also carry House Bill 3661 over to for a possible work session on Monday the 23rd. Okay.
Okay, with that, we are adjourned.
Mr. Chairman, let me just clarify also, you're carrying 2573 and 3659 over to Monday also for hearing a possible work session, is that correct?
Yes.
And then you had House Bill 2256, I have it in my notes, that you're carrying that over to Monday the 23rd also.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And you have House Bill 2894 to Wednesday, 25th, carried over for a possible work session.
Yeah. Okay. I almost cut my hand under there, didn't I?
We are
not the way you
adjourned.